This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Mr. Tom Ross on the 27th of September, year 2002, at approximately 2 o'clock. We are at the Ambassador Hotel in Bangkok, Thailand. Thank you, first of all, for agreeing to this interview.
And my pleasure, Steve.
Let's go ahead and talk about your early life. And if you would, just tell me when and where you were born, where you grew up.
I was born on the 20th of May, 1945. At that time, my mother was a lieutenant in the United States Army. My father was a captain in the United States Army Cavalry. Mm-hmm. They were married in Australia. Mm-hmm. She became pregnant mm-hmm. and was sent back to the States, and I was born in Chicago, Illinois.
Okay. Was she discharged?
She was discharged 7 days after the birth.
But she was discharged due to pregnancy?
Yes.
The fact that she was pregnant?
Yes.
7 days after you were born?
Yes. Don't ask me. I don't understand either.
Did you ever get a chance to, did you ever talk to her about that? The fact that the Army discharged her due to the pregnancy?
Well, that was automatically understandable because mm-hmm. women, officers in the Army Nurse Corps don't get pregnant.
Okay.
And another very interesting thing, that my mother, even though a World War II veteran, mm-hmm. was not allowed to join the VFW because she was a woman.
How does she feel about that?
She did not like it.
I would imagine not.
She was told that she could join the auxiliary with the rest of the women.
Okay.
Went to school in Auburn, Illinois. Mm-hmm. Grade school and high school. Mm-hmm. Auburn is a large community, probably around 2,000, counting mm-hmm. dogs, cats, and chickens.
Okay. What was it like growing up in small town Auburn?
It was enjoyable.
Yeah.
It was a small town. For punishment, they would send us outside to go play. You know, for punishment, they would send us in the house so we couldn't play outside.
Okay.
Now, with my kids, I have to send them outside so they can't go inside to play on the computers.
Okay.
But it was, everybody knew everybody. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, one thing wrong with it, if I ever did anything wrong, my mother knew about it within 5 minutes after I did it because one of the neighbors would have called her up and told her.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very secure. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, there was, you know, probably the biggest juvenile delinquency that we had. And there was, after the Methodist Youth Fellowship mm-hmm. meetings, some kids might shoot out streetlights with their BB guns.
Okay. What? How long did you stay in Auburn?
I left Auburn in 1965.
When you were 20?
Yes.
Okay, so you grew up there your entire life, I mean your early life.
Yes.
What did your dad do? Obviously, he didn't stay in the Army.
He died.
I'm sorry?
It was caused by lead poisoning.
Death?
A bullet.
Oh. Okay.
World War II.
Okay.
He was killed in the invasion of Luzon. World War II.
Okay.
So I was basically raised by my mother, which mm-hmm. was a nurse,
okay.
and she raised myself and my twin brother,
mm-hmm.
and basically my grandmother helped raise us also.
Yeah.
So, you know, my grandmother was, you know, there's a place for everything and everything has to be in its place,
mm-hmm.
and if you didn't put it back to where it's supposed to go, you got... let's say, punished.
Okay.
After high school,
mm-hmm.
I went to work for Alvis Chalmers in Springfield, Illinois,
okay.
building heavy equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And in 65, I was, you know, reading everything about the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
My family has been in the United States military since the Revolutionary War. Okay. Every military conflict, there's been somebody in the service. I have a great-great-grandfather was with the, what was it called, the Virginia Light Military under Colonel Lee, which was the great-grandfather of Robert E. Lee. And so it traces back to a large military portion. So that's basically why I joined the military.
Now, is that on both your mother's and your father's side of the family? That the,
yes.
The lineage goes back?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. On my mother's side, they immigrated to the United States in the 1600s.
Okay.
And there's history written that some of them were killed in the Indian Wars, but also traces back to Jamestown. So it's all on the computer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're talking about that genealogy on the internet.
Yeah, it's genealogy on the internet. You know, if you take the time and get everything correct, you can find out basically anything in genealogy.
Okay. Now, I'm sorry.
In 75, I volunteered for the Army. It was about, I guess, August 75. 65.
Okay.
Not 75, 65. Right. Volunteered for the Army. Went through training at Fort Lost in the Woods, Missouri, better known as Fort Leonard Wood. Then I went to Aberdeen Proving Grounds.
Okay. What did you sign up for your MOS?
Aircraft armament.
Okay. That's why you went to Aberdeen.
Yes.
Okay.
And airborne.
Where did you go to the drum school? Fort Benning?
Fort Benning.
Just out of curiosity, as you're growing up, you mentioned your mom was in the nurse course. So she worked as a nurse?
Yes.
Because you're working as a nurse?
Yes.
As you were going through school, were there any particular subjects that you enjoyed that you were drawn to?
Mathematics and history.
Okay. And who would you describe as being the more important role models in your life?
There was a football coach and principal at the high school named Fred Bradshaw.
Okay.
And he was a reserve Marine Corps major.
Okay.
And a Korean War veteran. And my high school graduating class, if I remember correctly, was 43.
Okay.
And we were, our football team was undefeated. And Major Bradshaw says, it is not the way you play the game. There's only one way is to win.
Okay.
And he says, if you get caught breaking the rules, that's wrong.
If you get caught.
If you get caught.
Okay. Any relation to other popular Bradshaws in football?
I don't know.
Oh, okay. Anybody else that was an important influence on you as a young man?
Patton.
Okay. Did you read a lot about him? And
I read about Patton, and one of my uncles served with Patton in World War II.
Okay.
And there was another book that I enjoyed reading. It was written by Field Marshal Rommel.
Mm-hmm.
It was his book about his exercises in World War I, which was very interesting.
Okay. You mentioned your uncle served with Patton. Did he talk to you very much about his military experiences? Was that something he was willing to talk about openly, or?
He talked about swimming in the Nile.
Okay.
getting shot for stealing, I believe it was sheep. In North Africa.
Okay. All right. How about other military or wartime experiences? Did you talk very much about his war experience?
Didn't talk about it.
Okay.
He was also the first VFW commander in Auburn, Illinois.
Oh, wow. What was his name?
Olin Greenwood.
When you decided to go into the Army, why did you choose that branch? Why not the Marine Corps? Why not the Air Force? Why the Army?
My mother was Army. My father was Army.
Yeah.
My uncle was Army.
Okay.
My grandfather was Army.
Family tradition.
And I don't know how far back it was Army.
Right.
And the United States Air Force still should be part of the Army.
Okay. So it should be the Air Corps, huh?
Army Air Corps.
All right. When you did go into the Army and you went off to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, what was the most surprising aspect of going in, being full-time active duty in the Army? Did anything surprise you about basic training?
The only thing that bothered me was taking brown boots and making them black.
Any difficulties with any training,
no.
Physical aspects, or
no.
Physical training, anything like that? What was the greatest challenge for you in basic training?
Greatest challenge.
If there was one. Some people didn't find any.
I didn't find any challenge in basic training.
Now, when you went in, you mentioned that you were reading about Vietnam, and when you made your decision about joining the Army.
Right. Well,
you've been reading about Southeast Asia.
The husband of one of my next-door neighbor's girls had been in Vietnam with the on a MAG advisor in 71.
Okay.
In 61. 61, not 70. In 61.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the first Americans to go over there.
Okay.
And he came back, and he was a artillery advisor, and got interesting. Then it was looking at the Eisenhower doctrine about the domino effect on what could possibly happen, which was very interesting.
It's okay.
So through listening to him, also. One of my hobbies was building rifles.
Okay.
Taking Mausers and rebarreling and rechambering them. And one of the guys I was working with in the gun club was Sergeant Spain, who happened to be an Army recruiter.
Okay.
So he said, well, you should take what you know already and then develop it more.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. A couple of questions about politics I should have asked before basic training. As you were growing up, and I guess as you were probably in your freshman sophomore year in high school, some really interesting events in U.S. history occurred. Of course, at the election in 1960, President Kennedy became president. After he became president, a couple of crises. Of course, probably the most important, the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. How important were these things to you as you were growing up? Were you paying very much attention to politics at that point in your life, or did that come later?
The missile crisis was very, very important, even down to the small farm community, because it was, okay, are we going to go to war with Russia? Russia is a threat to our freedom. So we must do something to stop this communist country from taking over, the domino effect again, taking over in Americas. Will it go from Cuba to Mexico to South America to Latin America? We must stop this now. And all of that was going on. Also around the same time, you had Sputnik. To deny it. Sputnik was put up, and the Russians are ahead of us in the space race.
Yeah.
No, they are beating us. We cannot let this happen. Mm-hmm. So all of it was a very, very much of nationalism. Mm-hmm. And it was the news media was not like the news media the way it is now. It was days after something happened that we found out about it, but it was discussed more openly mm-hmm. about what is going to happen. Is Russia setting up their missile bases in Cuba? They will attack the United States. Mm-hmm. Russia is leading in the space race. They've got the Sputnik up there. Mm-hmm. So it was very much I'm talking about small town Midwest, yeah. which basically is, we are an American.
Mm-hmm. Very patriotic.
Very patriotic.
No one questioned any of the policies that emerged that you knew of in your community?
The only question that was being raised was, why aren't we doing something faster?
Okay.
Why are we sitting on our asses not doing anything?
Okay.
Why did we allow missiles to go into mm-hmm. Cuba? Why didn't we stop them before?
Okay. So more on the hawkish end of reaction as opposed to...
Yes.
Why are we going to potentially invade that poor little country, Cuba?
Right.
Okay.
It was not, why haven't we?
Why haven't we done it yet? Okay. Well, what was the overall atmosphere... in your community about John Kennedy as president? Was there very much support for him? Do you remember?
The Central Illinois is basically going back mm-hmm. through centuries mm-hmm. as being Whig Republican. And with him being a Democrat, Irish, Catholic, do I need to say any more?
Probably not. I guess there wasn't a whole lot of support from there. Huh?
Right.
Okay. Well, how were you affected? Did you hear his inaugural speech? His call for people to,
it's not ask what you can do, what the country can do for you, but what you can
right.
do for the country.
Right.
This was very well brought to us that in the Midwest it is basically being hawkish. Mm-hmm. It is not that everybody was there to serve and not to ask why we have to serve. Mm-hmm. So that was basically going by what the people in the Midwest thought.
Yeah, it was basically preaching to the choir.
Right.
And people were very strong believers in that kind of sacrifice anyway. Okay. Well, let's continue then with your... Well, were there any other major political events or international events that stick out in your mind as a young person that had a profound effect on you?
Well, about the international events that happened there, if I remember right, there was the Suez Crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, again, why?
Yeah.
Why was it allowed to happen?
Mm-hmm.
And what was the cause and effect?
Mm-hmm.
But,
okay.
Yeah, the... probably reiterating, but Major Bradshaw, Mr. Bradshaw was also our history teacher.
Oh, okay.
And he made history very interesting because mm-hmm. he would say, okay, it was not, okay, this is what, this is World War II, da-da-da-da-da-da. Okay, he would go into if, then, else. Why, when, where.
Mm-hmm.
if we didn't do this, what would have happened? Mm-hmm. And he taught history as an analytical mm-hmm. process. Mm-hmm. And he would go into, you know, what we were doing, why we did it, what would happen if we did something else, mm-hmm. and for us to figure out ourselves by using history.
Okay.
He's a good teacher.
Sounds like it. Well, how did that apply to Southeast Asia when you, as you were looking at the news from coming from Vietnam, and you know, the United States became involved rather early on?
Well, it really wasn't Vietnam; it was Vietnam.
Okay.
Basically with the Eisenhower doctrine about the domino effect, where we were led to believe that if Vietnam fell, then we'd sow Cambodia, Laos, mm-hmm. Thailand, Malaysia, and it would scatter on through,
mm-hmm.
just rolling on over.
Right.
And it was even discussed by my grandmother in that time, and she was in her 70s, and she was basically a staunch Methodist. But
mm-hmm.
it was basically that, you know, this has got to stop.
Mm-hmm. So you were a strong believer in the domino theory, the threat that it posed.
I was a strong believer that that threat.
Mm-hmm.
The threat of communism threatened the United States.
Mm-hmm. What did you think at the time, though, about the application of the domino theory to Southeast Asia? Did you find that plausible as a young man that, yeah, if we don't go in and stop...
I accept it. Must be true.
Okay. Well, then, when the year before you went into the Army, you know, of course, with the Gulf of Tonkin incidents, the resolutions... and then the decision to build up American forces in Southeast Asia. Of course, that after making a campaign promise in 1964 that you know, he wasn't going to send American boys to fight an Asian war. What did you think about? Did that affect you at all?
No.
Yeah?
No.
Was there very much support for Johnson in the area where you were living in Illinois at the time?
No.
But still, we've got to do something to stop communism.
Right.
So a lot of support for the concept, if not the party, the president.
Right.
Okay. Well, when you made your decision to go into the Army, did you talk that over with your mom and your grandmother?
My grandmother already died.
Okay.
I talked it over with my mother. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, you'll probably go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She said, well, just don't get killed. And don't come back with a Japanese wife.
One out of Japanese wife.
My mother was World War II.
Okay. If you went to Vietnam, how about a Vietnamese wife?
Yeah, basically, they're all the same as far as she was concerned.
Okay. Okay. So she didn't have very many reservations about you going in.
No, she knew, you know, by past history, she knew it was going to be done.
Okay.
She didn't know which one of us was going to do it, but
yeah.
So yeah, automatically I went in, so she discouraged my brother from going in.
Okay. Did that work?
Yeah, he did not go in.
Okay. So when you finished up your basic training, and it was still 1965, you went in August, just a couple of months later, graduated from basic, and then went on to Aberdeen Proving Ground for your aircraft armament training. What did that involve? What was the focus of your aircraft armament training?
Basically, it was going into the weapon systems, mm-hmm. The rockets,
mm-hmm.
Electronics, hydraulics.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you know, we went through a electronics course that was... basically, the only other more difficult course was the one on computers that were being done. But remember back then,
mm-hmm.
the Sears and Roebuck add, subtract, multiply, divide
mm-hmm.
calculator had not come out yet.
Yeah.
So everything then was transistors and capacitors and resistors. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting.
And these are all armaments that were on, or mostly utilized on helicopters, or these were fixed wing, like the
basically,
L-19? And
basically, they were all helicopter type, but we were showing how to modify helicopter type to go on to fixed wing.
Okay. And you mentioned rockets, 2.75, I assume.
Yeah, SS-11B.
Okay.
SS-11B, which was a French-designed anti-tank, is before the TOW missile system.
Okay. And how about miniguns, you know, 50 cals, that kind of stuff? All of it?
Was not there then, before that.
Okay.
They were not being mounted on aircraft at that time.
Okay. How about 7.62 arm weapons?
M60.
Mm-hmm.
Twin mounted M60s on each side.
Mm-hmm.
Four of them,
mm-hmm.
two on each side.
Right.
With a 7 pod rocket launcher hanging down below.
What was the most challenging part of that training for you?
Electronics.
The electronics portion.
Yeah, basically all the electronics that we had in high school was how to wire a house.
Okay.
A little bit of difference.
Oh, absolutely. Did of course when you were growing up they had some really interesting kits, like radio kits and things like that that
crystals.
You could buy.
Crystal.
Yeah, based on the crystal technology and tube technology, the vacuum tube technology.
Right.
Did you ever play with that kind of stuff growing up?
I made a couple crystal radios.
Okay. So you did have some experience with electronics.
Yeah. But very limited.
Not extensive. Speaking of things you do as a youth, how important was television to you as a young person?
If I remember correctly, my mother bought a television in 1957.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about maybe 7 inches across, 8 inches across, mm-hmm. and it took up half the house.
Yeah, the box itself is huge, but the actual screen is very small. Yeah. Were there any programs that you enjoyed watching that you remember?
Yes. Hopalong Cassidy,
mm-hmm.
Lash LaRue, and Roy Rogers.
Mm-hmm. How about movies? Growing up, what kind of movies did you enjoy watching, going and seeing?
My mother made sure I seen at least 3 times Gone with the Wind.
Okay, well, that wasn't your choice; that was her choice. What movies did you like to see? What kind of movies?
Well, when I was growing up,
mm-hmm.
you must realize that my mother was raising 2 boys by herself.
Yeah.
So during the summer, I mowed grass for people, delivered newspapers, and also ran a movie projector in the local movie house.
Yeah, so you saw a lot of movies.
I saw a lot of movies.
Well, which ones did you enjoy?
I can't remember the name of the movie, but it was about Nanook of the North or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And there was two portions of it that were nude breast. And this is in the 50s.
Not totally nude.
Yes.
Really?
And, of course, me being a young projector operator, I censored it.
Did you really?
I did. I cut them out and kept them.
For crying out loud. You splice the film? You cut them out and you splice the film? Wow. But you don't remember the name of that movie?
I think it was Nanook of the West or Nanook of the North or something like that. It's an Eskimo movie.
Uh-huh.
And the actor on it was the same guy that was the Guns of Navarre.
Lee Marvin?
Not Lee Marvin.
He was no one's in that room.
It'll come to me. It'll come to me.
Okay. Other movies, memorable movies that you enjoyed. I mean, did you enjoy any of the World War II genre? Lots of interesting movies that came out after World War II. Some of them early, in the 40s, late 40s, early 50s, but...
Another movie that I enjoyed was The Manchurian Candidate.
Okay. 1963.
Yeah.
The same year the Kennedy was assassinated.
Right. That's what made it very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, The Blob.
Okay, yeah, Steve McQueen.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all about, this red thing.
This huge red blob.
Right.
Yeah, the metaphors there, the Cold War metaphors there. How about John Wayne and Lee Marvin and the other?
Not during high school.
Okay.
After high school.
Mm-hmm.
What was the one with Lee Marvin on the horse with the horse leaned up against the building? It's a classic.
Mm-hmm.
The horse is drunk.
Mm-hmm.
Lee Marvin is drunk. So he played two portions in the movie. One is the good guy, one is the bad guy. But he and the horse are drunk, and they lean up against a building.
Okay.
And it was good comedy.
Uh-huh. Okay. This wasn't a musical, was it?
No.
How about John Wayne movies? Did you enjoy them at all? Either his early stuff or his later westerns?
His later westerns, yes. Earlier stuff, no.
Like Sands of Iwo Jima, that kind of stuff, you didn't enjoy that very much?
Yeah. It was all phony.
Yeah.
And that's, the Green Beret was phony.
Mm-hmm.
It was, okay. But most people don't understand what the special forces really are. The special forces are really ours to go in, teach people,
mm-hmm.
lead them for a while, and make sure they're able to do the job. It's
teach them to defend themselves.
Teach them to defend themselves. That's like to liberate the oppressed.
Yes. The oppressor liber.
Yes.
Back to your military training again. When you finished your training in Aberdeen, did you have orders for Vietnam?
No.
Where did you go from there?
Benning.
Okay. Oh, this is where you went to jump school. What was that like for you?
Fun.
No, is this the 3-week course?
Yeah.
Okay. And what was most challenging about it? Anything?
The second jump.
All right. Now, why the second jump?
First one you don't know. Second one you do.
Okay. What did you guys? Did you go off the tower?
Yes.
200-foot towers.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, which was stolen out of Coney Island.
Okay.
Replaced.
And let's see. Anything other than the second jump challenge?
No, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Okay. Now, did you, after Fort Benning, did you go to a unit here in the United States first?
5th Aviation Battalion.
Uh-huh.
5th Infantry Division.
5th Aviation
Battalion, 5th Infantry Division.
Oh, 5th ID.
And, Carson, Fort Carson, Colorado.
Oh, yeah, Colorado. What was your assignment there? Just to work on the armaments on the helicopters and aircraft?
Yeah. Okay. And one of the interesting things there is myself and two other guys,
mm-hmm.
we were very adventurous. We climbed Pikes Peak. We went elk hunting in the Twin Rivers area. And but us being very intelligent people, I had the elk in the sights, and I said, who's going to carry this thing out? So we decided that I was not going to shoot that.
Had you hunted very much growing up?
Yes.
Okay. What did you mean principally?
Rabbit, squirrel, dove, deer. I'd had a weapon in my hand since I was about 10, 11 years old.
Would you typically eat or kill?
Yes. I never would kill anything I wouldn't eat.
Okay.
I never overkill either.
So how long did you spend in Fort Carson?
Six, 7 months. I guess that's about that.
How did you change your duty assignment?
I was convinced to volunteer for OCS.
Okay.
The first sergeant was trying to get me to go to the NCO Academy,
mm-hmm.
and the captain was wanting me to go to OCS. It was Anthony Quinn.
Yes, in Guns of Navarone.
No, Guns of Navarone, but he's also on the Nook of the North.
Okay. All right. Have to write that name down.
And it's surprising what happens when you go to the bathroom.
Oh, yeah. It comes, the memory sparks. Now, you volunteered to go to, or you applied to go to OCS.
Yes.
At the urging, I guess, of your commander or someone in your chain of command.
Right.
And you did go.
Yes.
What was that training? Where was it again?
Aberdeen.
Back at Aberdeen. OCS at Aberdeen.
OCS at Aberdeen also. The TAC officer and I did not see eye to eye.
Okay.
His name was Edsel R. Adkins, and we affectionately called him Lurch.
Okay.
Why
Lurch?
Because he looked like Lurch.
All right.
We started out with two barracks,
mm-hmm.
and graduated half a barracks.
Whoa.
And he basically informed me that I would not graduate because I was already a sergeant and I was airborne.
What did that have to do with anything?
He had a personality conflict.
Okay. But that didn't happen.
No.
You graduated.
I graduated.
What would you ascribe to the high attrition in that school?
Basically, the first portion of OCS is mental and physical degradation of the person, which is good. Because to be able to bring it esprit de corps to indoctrinate a person, you got to bring them to a level that they can be trained.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that, you bring them down to the very basics.
Mm-hmm.
Same as special forces, same as airborne, mm-hmm. same as SEALs training. The first 3 months is basically physical and mental training,
mm-hmm.
and it is difficult. And I would say 50% of the people that washed out,
mm-hmm.
washed out in the first month and a half.
Okay.
At that time, we're talking about 66. There's a large requirement for carts to haul. For military personnel.
Mm-hmm. It's the build-up in Vietnam.
The build-up in Vietnam. There was shake-and-bake sergeants.
Mm-hmm.
A guy would come out of AIT and be a sergeant. There was a large requirement for the officer corps.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an OCS just would weed out the people that could not take it. That's like airborne. You weed out the people that cannot do it. Mm-hmm. Special forces, SEALs, everything. Weed them out and then train them. Mm-hmm. Get rid of the chaff. Mm-hmm. You know, call the pigs. Get them out of there. Mm-hmm. And then train what you got left over.
Okay. What was the most challenging part of OCS for you?
Putting up with Virg.
But sometimes that is the most challenging part, is the personality conflict.
I was a senior candidate, and it was one of these things that you got 30 seconds for everybody to be outside in formation. Mm-hmm. And I was the first one heading out the door, and he slammed the door, watching me coming out the door, and he slammed the door, and I took the door off the hinges. I've got scars on my hands and across my face here where I took the door out and broke the glass.
Okay.
I didn't quit. Mm-hmm. And I got sent to the clinic, got stitched up, and went right back into training. Mm-hmm. And on a couple other occasions, he kept telling me that I was going to quit. No way.
So the most challenging part was dealing with him?
Yeah, his personality.
Yeah. Anything else as far as the physical aspects or the classroom aspects of the training that were challenging or difficult?
In aircraft armament, I was top of my class. Mm-hmm. In OCS, I was number two. So it was basically a challenge. Mm-hmm. But all challenges, if it's not a challenge, it's not worth doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Were many of the instructors or other TAC officers Vietnam veterans?
None of the TAC officers were Vietnam vets. The company commander and the brigade commander were Vietnam vets.
In the training, was there very much talk of Vietnam and
yes.
What you as an officer might find yourselves doing?
Yes. There was, we went through a week mm-hmm. of Vietnam scenario mm-hmm. To include villages, booby traps, mm-hmm. and things like that.
How realistic did you find that training?
All the people that were doing the training were Vietnam vets.
So they were doing a pretty good job?
Yes. Okay.
And what did when you applied for OCS, did you have a specific branch in mind? Are you in a branch?
I wanted infantry because I wore glasses and I was already aircraft armament. Mm-hmm. They sent me to ordnance.
Okay. Where did you did you stay there at Aberdeen for your ordnance officer training?
Yes.
Okay. And what was that like? How was that different from being? How much more different was that from being an enlistedman working with ordnance as opposed to an officer managing it all?
Well, what was interesting that I'm going through some classes on weapons.
Yeah.
And a E5 Kawazumi mm-hmm. was the instructor.
Kawazumi?
Yes, Japanese American.
Yes, sounds Japanese.
Yeah. And Kawazumi and I went to aircraft armament together.
Oh, okay.
So I'm there listening to him.
Yeah.
And he looks down. And he goes, the TAC officer standing, he says, well, Candidate Ross, why don't you come up here and give a class?
Oh, that's funny.
And the TAC officer did not know it. Mm-hmm. So I went up there, and I said, oh, okay, Instructor Calasone, your class is on. It was on light weapons and everything. I went through the light weapons and everything like that. The attack officer getting. He says, "Why is it he knew that you knew?" "I have no idea, sir." But, you know, a lot of the guys there at Aberdeen and I knew each other. Mm-hmm. So it made it interesting.
Mm-hmm. What were the challenging things about ordnance officer training?
Boring.
Not really? Because you knew so much about the ordnance already.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we had a lot of guys in there that were fresh out of college and things like that. And okay, this is a M16 rifle. Okay, it's an M16 rifle. So it was interesting.
Mm-hmm. From an ordnance officer standpoint, what did you think about the M16? You know, it was a controversial weapon.
I liked the M14 better than I did the M16. The M14 was basically a modified Garand. The M16 at a later date became a much better weapon after it was modified. And the modification helped out a lot. But I still prefer the M14.
Okay. And did you already have a duty assignment when you graduated from
Yes,
ordnance
I did.
Training?
Yes, I did.
And that was?
Thailand.
No, as an Army ordnance officer, what would you be doing in Thailand?
I was with the 558 supply company,
mm-hmm.
heavy material, general support,
mm-hmm.
in charge of classified military projects in Thailand.
Okay. Of course, there's been a lot written about the U.S. Air Force in Thailand.
Yes.
But a much less known aspect of the U.S. involvement in this country, in Thailand, is the Army was also rather involved.
Yes.
The
project that we had, there was a project for a pipeline to go from Sadaheb Deep Sea Port
mm-hmm.
to Uban and NKP. All that material was here in Thailand. There was another project for a railroad to go in from Sadaheb to Bangkok to join with the railroad in Nakhon Ratchasima. All of the track and materials here in Thailand, the moving equipment was stored in Okinawa.
Okay.
There was equipment, vehicles, armament, tanks here in Thailand to support the 25th Infantry Division to go into Laos.
Okay.
That project was basically stopped when the Geneva Accord was made
mm-hmm.
For that we would not support any operations in Laos.
Mm-hmm. 1963.
But all that equipment was here to include tanks.
So as an ordnance officer working here in Thailand, what was your principal responsibility?
To ensure that all that equipment was maintained and got to the personnel that it was supposed to go to.
Okay.
We outfitted the Queen's Cobras,
mm-hmm.
Black Panthers,
mm-hmm.
All special forces operations in Thailand were mm-hmm. out. Were equipped by us. That's why I was attached to the 46 Special Forces.
That's where you were attached?
I was attached to the 46 Special
mm-hmm.
as a provider.
Okay. Did you do many jumps after you left jump school?
I made two jumps in Thailand.
Okay.
In Vietnam, I made a jump.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because I wanted to. It was not the jumps in Thailand was because I wanted to. It mm-hmm. wasn't because
yes.
I didn't jump at
for the fun of it.
Yeah.
Okay. So you worked closely with Special Forces?
And Just Mag.
And Just Mag.
We were also responsible for pepper grinder and salt shaker.
Okay. Pepper grinder and salt shaker. Would you explain what those are?
Those were ammo storage locations in Karat, Udorn, and Pakchan. And basically all the material, all the ammo that came in, came into us.
Okay.
Also at those locations that we had all the material to support the maneuvers of the 25th, if it did come.
25th Infantry?
Yeah.
Okay. What size was the Special Forces contingent that you were working with?
It was 46th. The 46th was a Special Forces company.
Okay.
The commander was Colonel Bartel, Lieutenant Colonel Bartel.
Okay.
Basically, by being assigned, attached to, basically what I was doing was reporting to Bartelt and his direct staff, even though I was a first lieutenant and then a captain, was to provide material to them where it was needed, when it was needed.
Okay.
One of the most enjoyable problems I had was that there was a military camp up along the Burmese Laotian border that needed to be resupplied, and we finally figured out two ways of supplying it. One was by a mule team, so they transferred out of Fort Carson, Colorado, the last active duty mule team from the United States to Thailand, and also determined that the best way to supply it was I was provided an Empress fund for elephants.
How many?
And I don't remember, but we rented elephants to supply bases upon the Laotian Burmese border in
Chiang Rai. What were the elephants used for?
To put packs on.
They were pack animals.
Pack animals.
Pack-a-derms,
right. That's a nice way of putting it.
Now, did your unit provide support for, you mentioned the Queen's Cobras, Black Panthers, as Thai units. What about the Peru, the other paramilitary, Thai paramilitary organizations? Did you provide more support for them as well?
We would issue the equipment and the weapons to the local Just Mag advisors, which would then provide it to whoever got it.
Okay. And let's see. In terms of the classified military projects that you supported, were those principally the Special Forces? That is the classified project, or principally
The classified projects was the pipeline, the railroad, the 25th Infantry Division, and the support, the direct support of the Queen's Cobras, Black Panthers, and the Special Forces.
Okay.
And what was really making the local United States military generals very pissed off, being General Black and General Ott, we did not report to them. We reported directly to Okinawa. Our orders came from Okinawa, not from the local user subtai.
Why? Do you know?
There was numerous occasions that we would get communications from the local commanders saying, "Well, you have this equipment there, and I need a new Jeep." That's why I can't give you a new Jeep. Being General Black.
Okay.
Your Jeep must go through the regular Army sources.
Yeah.
It cannot come from me.
Because what you're using is committed to these other projects.
Right.
You can't just start
giving it to everybody.
Anyone who just wants something.
Right.
Okay. And so that, okay, so that's why it had to be controlled by a different source to prevent that kind of stuff from happening. Okay. When When you were working in Thailand, when did you arrive here?
September 67.
Okay.
Left October 69.
This being 4 years after the Geneva Accords that affected Laos, of course, Operation White Star, the introduction of U.S. Special Forces into Laos, that had ended as a result of the Accords of 63.
Yes.
Officially.
Supposedly. That's why the 46th was here.
I was just going to say, it seems, though, that other Special Forces personnel were operating out of Thailand into Laos after 63. Ununiformed.
They were agricultural advisors, forestry advisors, language teachers, agriculturers. They dug a lot of ditches. They showed people how to make ditches and things like that.
I see. So they were not military advisors. They were civil affairs advisors.
Correct. At Air America.
In reality, or just on paper?
On paper.
Okay. What was the extent of the support that you could provide from Thailand? Was it aerial resupply into Laos as well, or was it just they'd have to come back, get what they need, and go back?
A message would be relayed to us, whether it be physically or by a telephone or by a radio message, that certain places needed certain things. And it would be provided to them. Mm-hmm. I probably can give you court martial for this if I was still in the United States military, but I'm not. Pak Chan, a Special Forces training base, ran out of the generator went bad. Mm-hmm. And they needed a generator.
Okay.
I'm in the officers' club in Korat, talking with a lieutenant colonel that is in charge of the storage depot. And I knew he had two generators that I needed. Mm-hmm. And I am there on the slot machine right next to him, drinking. And the next night I go in there, and he started cussing and hollering at me, trying to accuse me of stealing two generators out of his secure depot.
Okay.
I informed the lieutenant colonel that how could I steal his generators if I was standing at a slot machine right next to him.
Right.
And he said, I know you had something to do with that. And I said, well, I just cannot understand that, colonel, because I was right here with you. Right. But I also know there was a helicopter that went in without any lights on it, that slung out two generators from the middle of his storage depot.
Okay. Okay. And delivered them where they needed to be. Okay.
That was relayed to me.
Okay. Okay. Well, what other resupply did you have to provide? I would imagine it's just ran the gamut. All kinds of material, food, weapons, ammunition.
The most difficult thing I ever had to supply was toilet paper.
Really? Okay. Okay. Toilet paper was in greatest demand and least supply. But when you were providing support to American teams working in Laos, you'd support them with everything that you had available.
If I didn't have it, I knew where it was.
Now, were they working in close proximity to some of the Hmong or the Miao forces in Laos?
Special Forces is trained to go in and teach, equip, and lead. Mm-hmm. Yes, they were working very closely with indigenous forces. Yes, they were providing basically carbines, M1 Karans, BARs. We'd find the smallest guy and give him a BAR. But Yeah, we provided all support.
Okay. To include to the indigenous forces?
Correct.
Wow. Now, how much interaction was there between, I guess, the 46th Special Forces, the 558th, and some of the other groups that were working rather extensively in Laos, whether they be the CIA, Air America?
Well, sometimes the Special Forces people were called CIA people.
Okay. And they did nothing to discourage that?
Well, it was basically incorrect nomenclature. But, the guy was there. Mm-hmm. He was not Air America. He was not Air Force. He was wearing civilian clothes, so he must be CIA.
Right. But was there very much, joint cooperation between you and what you were doing and what Air America was doing, what the CIA was doing? You know, if they needed something up country Laos and they couldn't get their hands on it, would they ever interact with you and try to get it through you?
No. It's somebody else. I would provide things that I did not know where it was going.
Okay.
There was never a direct interaction.
Okay.
I would say, somebody would say, I need 100,000 rounds of 30-06. Okay. No questions asked. Issue it. Deliver it to wherever. It would be either put on a truck and deliver it, or take it out to the airhead and put on the back of C-130 or C-1, whatever it was. C-7A, whatever it was.
Okay. Now, were those typically military aircraft, or were there also civilian aircraft involved?
Majority of it was military aircraft.
Majority?
In Thailand. Yeah. I would say, as far as I can remember, it was 100% military aircraft.
Okay.
Most likely, the military aircraft was taking it to another staging location to be further delivered.
Okay. And did you ever find yourself short of anything that you really needed? Toilet paper. Besides the toilet paper, I mean, things of perhaps a more immediate military need. Anything that you requested from the field that they needed desperately, but you guys just couldn't quite put your hands on it.
Bailey Bridge.
I'm sorry, explain that.
Bailey Bridge.
Bailey Bridge?
There was a big flood going on. I guess it must have been 67 or 68.
Uh-huh.
And the roads were washed out between Udorn and NKP.
Mm-hmm.
And the materials was not able to get to where it was supposed to go.
Okay.
And I had to acquire a Bailey Bridge to go in there to put in a bridge that was out.
Okay.
And we acquired the Bailey Bridge.
Oh, okay. But it wasn't something that was readily available. You had to acquire it somehow.
Yes.
Okay.
We got it out of Okinawa.
Okay.
And brought it in on an unscheduled 141.
Okay. How difficult was it to arrange that kind of
back channel messages. The requirement came up, and within, I guess it was 4 or 5 days, we had it.
Wow. Okay. Now, for the time you were here from 1967 to 69, a lot of interesting events, of course, occurred, especially in Vietnam. Tet Offensive 1968.
Tet Offensive 1968. During the Tet Offensive, we were on red.
Okay.
Ammunition was stored in containers next to the supply room. We went on an alert at least 3 or 4 times during that. During that time, I was running a payroll mission for my forces into Udorn, and was traveling armed.
Okay.
I had a base in Udorn, which basically had six Americans. It's outside of Udorn. Mm-hmm. Six Americans and about 12 or 13 Thais that were taking care of special projects. And the special projects were basically making sure the equipment and materials was delivered to where it was supposed to go to up north.
Okay. When did things calm down? How long after Tet?
I guess it was 4 or 5 months.
Okay.
I took my, we took our tanks and our track equipment and cleared a perimeter completely around the Karat Air Force and Karat Army bases, Camp Friendship, cleared a perimeter around the whole area. And right behind Camp Friendship, there was a school, and the kids loved it, seeing all these tanks going by, dragging chains, clearing out the jungle. What we did was tie large chains in between tanks and draw the chain and cleared everything out.
Now, was there a general alert throughout Thailand, do you know? Especially, for instance, for the Thai forces, were they also put on alert during Tet?
Okay. Well, it was very much of a political thing for the Thais because they were also believers in the domino effect. And they used it to their advantage to receive extra military grants and other developmental grants from the United States government to some of it went to for what it was supposed to do and some of it went other areas.
Now, as you were living here in Thailand and getting to know more about the people and the culture and the politics internal to Thailand, did you come to recognize that there was any kind of internal communist threat within Thailand itself? Did you get any hints of that while you were here?
Yeah, a lot of things were accused of being communist threats, which maybe were and maybe weren't.
Okay. Does this tie into that the desire or attempt to get funding and recognition
from
the United States?
There was an attack on on Udorn, the sappers came through and put satchel charges on the Udorn air base. Yeah, I was sitting across the street playing cards in a bar upstairs, and the satchel charges went off, and my Thai guy came in and gave me my M16 and walked back out. And so I said, well, let's play cards. And I started winning. there was a lot of the supposed communist insertion that was being done was people that were not exactly attuned to where the government was being run. During the time of Thanom Kittikorn, if you did not agree with what he wanted or the way he was saying things should be done, you were a communist. One of the persons that is supposedly one of the great heroes of Thailand today, Pitee, was labeled a communist. And he left the country and he died in France. He never came back. Of course, right when he left the country, he went to China. And so he was automatically labeled a communist. Whether it's a, whether communism is good or bad, it really means nothing. If it's the way that the administrators running the process are actually doing it. Because communism as itself, as a doctrine, is good. The way it's run is bad. Because a utopian type theory is good. Basically what the Pretty wanted to do, he was one of the leaders of the 1932 revolution. And basically what he wanted to do was set up a utopian type process. And he was automatically labeled communist.
Were there any other high tension periods in terms of an alert or concern of a possible attack while you're here for those 2 years? 67, 69?
There was, whether they were actual problems or not, there was alerts called. You know, the areas were restricted. You could not go into these areas because of communists. And whether it was basically communist or whether the local officials did not agree with the provincial officials or something like that, they're automatically labeled as being whatever. There was areas in the northeast where, because of the way the politicians were running things, they were going in and, okay, this guy doesn't agree with me, this area doesn't agree with me, going in and killing people. Automatically, they did not go to the side of the government, and it caused problems. Okay. But as far as being any problems for Americans or anything like that, that wasn't that much. There was problems where if Americans were seen to being a direct support of Kittyacorn, there was a problem. Around large military installations, there was problems, bar fights, girlfriends, whiskey, those type of problems. But there was a fire in Karat, and the United States military went in to help the Thai firefighters put the fire out. And that was seen as all being good. But whether there was actual bang nai, whether it was, you know, there was communist activity going on, but what they preyed upon was the lack of education, the lack of economics in the local area, and they used that to say the government is not taking care of you, so we will take care of you. But it really wasn't that bad.
Were there any particular periods during that time frame, the 67-69 time frame, where there were peaks, high demand for, you know, where you'd get inundated with requests, hey, we need lots of stuff up country right now?
Chet, okay. We moved a lot of material. Mm-hmm. Supplying of Queen's Culvers and Black Panthers. Material had to be processed, brought up. We would take it and get it into as new as possible and issue it to the Thais.
Okay.
There was a, can't remember the name, the number of the aircraft. There was a surveillance aircraft that went off the runway there in Karat, and the Air Force had no way of recovering it, and we went in and recovered it for them.
You too?
No. Four-engine, three-tail. Right. I can't remember.
Okay.
Had a mushroom on top.
Okay.
It's not coming to me right now.
Electronics.
Electronic, yeah. And we recovered it for them. Took in M88 track recovery vehicles and recovered it. But that's about it. There was a couple you know, the elephants require to, you know, the mule team being transferred out of Carson to here, you know. These mules don't eat rice. Think about it. Mules don't eat rice. They eat corn. They eat oats. Of course, nobody thought about that.
So did you have to import that feed?
Yes.
Let's see. Other interesting places in Thailand that come to mind. Did you ever provide support for any operations out of Thak Vit that you know of?
Equipment only.
Equipment only?
Yeah.
Okay. And would you know what kind of missions those were?
Never ask questions.
Okay. Some in-country life experience questions. And here you are, an American soldier living in Thailand.
I died and went to heaven.
Okay. What? Explain. How was that so? How did Thailand become heaven for you?
I flew into San Francisco. And I went to the Oakland Army Terminal.
Okay.
And they looked at my orders and said, "Oh, Thailand, you are assigned to this unit. You must have an official passport,
right.
A red passport."
Yeah.
So I went down to downtown San Francisco, got my official passport, flew into Thailand, and came in, and they put me up at the Chao Phraya Hotel.
Okay.
3 second lieutenants from the same graduating class in OCS.
Mm-hmm.
And I says, "Okay, you guys, shit, shower, shave, 30 minutes downstairs." You walk out the door of the Chao Phraya Hotel, which is now the Siam Hotel,
mm-hmm.
on Soe Soe Ayutthaya.
Mm-hmm.
And we walk out the door, and a taxi cab driver says, "You want to eat, or do you want something else?" And we said something else.
Okay.
And
what was something else?
We went to the Boston Bar.
The Boston Bar.
Boston Bar.
Okay.
And there were some very attractive young ladies.
Okay.
And it was interesting. The next morning, we're on an aircraft being flown up to Korat. And we land there in Korat. And the company commander picked us up, and we went from Korat down to Friendship, which was basically right next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very religious person.
Okay.
And so we got to know all of our people. And all of a sudden, he realized that he had 3 of the most dangerous second lieutenants he'd ever seen in his life.
Okay.
The warrant officer, Lamb, was in charge of the ammo dump. And he said, "Well, you lieutenants need to go downtown." We went downtown with warrant officer Lamb. And we lost him,
mm-hmm.
and we got back, and it was interesting. Later on went to a place called Venus Hideaway, a restaurant.
Oh, okay.
A restaurant, and some of the best food in Korat,
mm-hmm.
Venus Hideaway. She later moved her restaurant right off to the... right off the end of the runway, right across from Korat Air Force Base, And if I remember correctly, she married a colonel doctor from the Army hospital and went back to the States. Good food. There was a myself and the other lieutenants, we had a credit card for a bar whorehouse in Korat also, because after the first 2 weeks of the month, we would run up a tab, and she would charge it to our credit card.
Okay.
And it was for her bar only. And she kept very good books.
Well, did you find yourself mostly eating on the economy in Thailand? I mean, they must have had mess facilities, but...
Yeah. They had mess facilities. The Korat Officers Club, there was the general's table. At the end of the dining facility, there was the general's table for the general staff. Mm-hmm. So us young officers, we tipped the waitresses and the waiters and the cooks much better than the generals and his staff did. So they set us up a table which was on a 90 degree to the general's table. And the general was complaining because we get better service than he did.
You tip better, you get better service.
Also, General Ott had a party for one of his colonels that was going away, and the General Ott's wife was there, and she was the only American woman in the area, and they had a party. So we turned her party into a very interesting one. We went downtown and got the ugliest women that we could find and brought it to her party.
Oh, goodness.
For some reason, the general thought it was funny, but she didn't.
I wonder why. How about lodging? Did you guys live on the base or out on the economy?
We lived on the base. We lived in a teak. Four-bedroom facility, and the sides of it were at a 45-degree angle, so the air could circulate through, and inside of that was screen wire to keep mosquitoes out. But in Korat, it would rain so hard that it would rain sideways, and the water would still come in.
Any other interesting aspects of just living in Thailand?
I fell in love with the food, customs, culture. I converted from Methodist to Buddhist.
Okay.
Which is, my mother was not exactly happy with that.
I'd imagine not.
But I find Buddhism to be... Buddhism is not a religion. Buddhism is a way of life. And it's the sum total of your good and bad deeds will determine your hereafter. It's not that I will confess all my sins and be granted the holy extinction or whatever it is. Sum total of your good and bad deeds will determine your hereafter. I believe in reincarnation.
Okay. When did you start learning the language?
I went to language school.
When did you go there? Is that after OCS?
After OCS, I went through a fast course.
How long?
2 months.
How effective?
They taught me Bangkok Thai. Bangkok Thai spoken in Bangkok. They don't speak Bangkok Thai up north.
Is it really that different, how they speak Thai here in Bangkok and how they speak it in northern Thailand?
Back 35 years ago, yes. Okay. You go up into the northeast and they speak almost Laotian.
Yeah, okay.
So it's quite different.
And that's where you were?
Yeah.
You were a country. Okay. So that part of it wasn't as effective?
Was not effective, no.
How long, when you got here, how long did it take you to convert to the new tie and start really? I mean, the two-month course is not going to prepare you.
No, it was basically an indoctrination course.
Right.
The Finnish Language Institute, from the time you go in till you leave, you are not allowed to speak English. Mm-hmm. It's 100% immersion. Mm-hmm. So that was food, everything. Mm-hmm. So it was very intense and it was very good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, when you got here in 67, the attitude of the United States towards the war was still pretty upbeat, pretty positive. Were you getting news and were you learning about how that was changing over the course of your 2 years here, how the American attitude towards the wars in Southeast Asia was changing?
Basically, what we'd read in the Stars and Stripes,
okay.
And basically it was nothing.
So you weren't getting like Newsweek and Time and other popular
magazines? Oh, we were getting Newsweek and Time, but who the hell wanted to read that?
Okay.
You know, Stars and Stripes,
mm-hmm.
Bangkok Post.
Mm-hmm.
There was another Bangkok paper. I can't remember the name of it now. We called it the top secret paper because it had a red border on the side of it.
Okay.
But can't remember what that was called. But you know, it was basically we heard about Tet and other things that were going on.
Yeah.
Basically, we had our job to do from day to day, and basically we didn't get involved with that.
You didn't pay attention very much to that, no. Correct, from the United States. Now, did you notice that much of a difference from the time you got in Thailand to the time you left, especially in terms of American involvement, American the pace of American operations?
The amount of throughput that we were doing and the amount of training that we were doing increased rapidly.
Okay.
It got to the point that in 68, mm-hmm. in the early part of 69, we were working 24/7,
okay.
just to keep everything moving. It was just to be able to basically it was getting the ties equipped, getting the equipment into four locations.
Mm-hmm.
And getting everything moving, it was just all the time.
Okay. Well, after the major push, Tet of 68, it was March of 68, Johnson decided not to seek re-election.
Right.
Of course, the 1968 election, in which Nixon won, did you have an opportunity to vote in that election? Did they make sure that you got your ballot and so you know, you guys overseas could vote?
No.
You didn't?
Matter of fact, the last, I hate to say this, but it's the truth, the last election I voted in was I voted for Goldwater.
In 64? Okay.
Well, I didn't exactly vote, but I made sure my mother voted for Goldwater to make sure that, damn it, going to drop the bomb, let's drop it and get the shit over with.
Okay. Well, what did you think about Nixon? Did you have any opinion at the time?
At the time.
I know later your opinion has become quite...
At the time, I was sure that he had the right ideas and we were going to get the job done and get the hell out of there and get it done properly.
Okay. So you had confidence that the Nixon administration was going... What about Vietnamization? When you heard about that, what did you think of that as a policy?
At that time, I felt that the complete Vietnam operation should have been left to a well-trained advisor and the special forces.
Okay. So this was a move in the right direction.
Correct.
This Vietnamization was putting the fighting back in the hands of the Vietnamese themselves.
Okay. Correct.
Now, when you left in October of 1969,
I went to Bragg.
You went to Bragg. But what did you, when you left Thailand, how did you feel about what you've been doing here for 2 years?
Everything was being scaled back.
Okay.
The operations that I was involved with were basically finished. New operations were coming in.
Mm-hmm.
We are being phased out, and the new guys coming in on the new operations are going into their operations. Or we were basically phased out.
Mm-hmm.
Reason for that, if the operation you're working on is finished and you're getting ready to leave, there's no reason to bring you into a new operation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Large portions of the roads have been built.
Mm-hmm.
The ammo dumps had been built. The transportation system had been set up.
Mm-hmm.
The transportation system went from the United States Army to the Express Transportation Organization run by the Thai government.
Okay.
They were hauling the ammo, not us. They were hauling the bombs, not us. So from what we were doing, went over to the Thai government.
And how did you feel about American policy when you left? Did you think we were doing the right thing?
Yes.
In Southeast Asia?
Yeah.
Did you think it was effective?
Didn't know, didn't care.
Okay.
I was a captain, basically. I was, if they told me to do certain things, I would do it. But, I was seeing a lot more of the influx of the advisors and the SF.
Mm-hmm.
Even though area commanders like Ott and General Ott, General Black in Thailand, did not like the special forces because they did not come under their control. Mm-hmm. Same as I did not come under their control.
Mm-hmm.
We came under control of Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were not under their responsibility.
Right.
They did not have the control of us. There was this thing here, sitting here, this parasite,
mm-hmm.
and they're doing something, and we don't know what the hell they're doing, and why don't we know what they're doing? It's a separate entity. Understandably, here's an army organizations,
mm-hmm.
or two or three army organizations, that do not report to the Army commander in charge of Thailand.
Right. It's kind of upsetting.
And certain people reported directly to the American ambassador and did not report anything to the commanding general of the USSR Subtai.
Now, did you travel to Laos at all during the 2 years?
Going in and out, back mm-hmm. and forth,
mm-hmm.
making deliveries, just, odd jobs.
Did you get shot up flying in Laos?
I seen tracers, but whether I was being shot at or whether somebody else is being shot at, it's like all my time in Vietnam. There was guys that shot at me, and mm-hmm. I shot back at them, and basically I only know of one person I killed, and
mm-hmm.
that was about from across this table away, so I know he was dead.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the time, I spent a lot of rounds,
mm-hmm.
whether he was dead or not, or whether I didn't stick around to find out.
Yeah.
It's shoot, move, communicate.
Mm-hmm.
Don't stick. If you stick around, somebody else is going to shoot at you.
Yeah. Well, what took you to Fort Bragg in 1969 when you came back?
Training.
Was this to be an advisor?
Yes.
Advisor training?
Yes.
At the JFK Center?
Yes. You know your history very well.
No, thanks. What was the emphasis in that training?
majority of these people going through training had not been to Southeast Asia before. I would say 20% of it was on customs, culture, language. Mm-hmm. We had guys coming in who didn't know how to read a goddamn map, and they were going to be signed as an advisor.
That's
a problem. You know, yeah. Guys that, you know, you would start going the phonetic alphabet, and they were lost.
Were these lieutenants? First or second lieutenants? Coming from
a lot of them, yeah, we had, in my class, we had first lieutenants, captains, and majors.
Okay.
I think the major could not read a map.
That's not good.
Yeah. And he was going to be a district senior advisor. To say the least, he did not go to that assignment. There was a weeding program on that also.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was the attrition in your class at Fort Bragg?
Probably around 30%. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest attrition is at, you go for a mile run.
Okay.
It's called the Mad Mile.
Okay. Why was it the Mad Mile?
Because anybody that thought that was a mile was mad, because it was 5 miles through the sand in the North Carolina timber.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And every time we ran it, this goddamn Marine Corps captain always beat me. Mm. He was first and I was second. Mm-hmm. So I was pissed off. I'm talking with some of the old boys. Out of the 46, I said, somebody's got to stop that fucker. And, Captain, you know we cannot do what you're talking. Mm-hmm. And I said, I know you can't do it, but I'm going to beat that goddamn Marine Corps fucker. And the last race that we had, he stumbled.
Oh, no.
Yeah, he stumbled.
And you won.
I won.
So you're right. You're going to be. Well, how did you find that training, having had a lot of in-country experience, 2 years in Thailand? How realistic was it? Did you think that they did a good job of tailoring it to the real world?
They put a world out there that a lot of people could not understand. Mm-hmm. That was very, very well done.
Okay.
It was very well done. One of the things that was a requirement was that you were given a list of subjects, and you had to produce a training situation. Mm-hmm. On one of these subjects. Mm-hmm. And you had to present it not to the other people in the class, it was to the cadre.
Okay.
And you were graded on your ability to research the data, mm-hmm, and produce the class for the cadre. Mm-hmm. And that was interesting. That was challenging.
What were the subjects like?
There were language, customs, culture, religion, you know, anything that nothing like heavy weapons or light weapons or technical operations. It all had to do with what was being taught to you about the operation of a RFPF organization. How would you go about running an RFPF organization? Mm-hmm. Things like that.
Now, did you know that upon completion of your training, you'd be going to Vietnam to work with the regional force, popular force units?
No.
Where, did you have an assignment yet?
All I knew was I was going to Vietnam.
Okay.
When I left, I was called out of class 2 weeks early.
Okay.
And sent to Mekong Delta.
Oh, wow.
because there was a requirement. And it turned out, I didn't know it at the time, that they had a graduation, early graduation party for three of us. Mm-hmm. So I'm there at the early graduation party, the class before us was graduating. So we were invited to go to that class. And going through there, and this nice young lady says, "You wouldn't happen to be the Captain Ross that was in Thailand, would you?" Said, "Yes, ma'am." She said, "You know my husband." "I do." "Yes, Colonel Hartell." "What's a nice girl like you to be married to a guy like that?" And it was, he was not able to attend, but he was there as the, he was in charge of the classes.
Okay.
And
at Fort Bragg.
At Fort Bragg.
Okay.
And it was interesting. Nice Filipino lady. And I understand after Colonel Bartelt retired, he got his, became a lawyer, mm-hmm. and he was serving as a divorce lawyer in Fort Bragg, probably making a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, how much language training did you get?
Cram courses. Three, 4 hours a day.
For how long?
2 months.
Okay. How effective was that when you found yourself in Vietnam? Again, just the basics?
It was just the basics.
Yeah.
It was just the basics. But one of the interesting things, all new advisors going into an area, the battalion senior advisor that I was replacing was still there. Mm-hmm. And he did not know I'd been to Bragg. Mm-hmm. And he did not know I was in Thailand. So having the welcome the new advisor party. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden here comes the chicken feet and the chicken head and the chicken blood with mm-hmm. the peanuts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm the guest of honor. I get the chicken head. I get the chicken feet. So, start eating chicken head. And the Vietnamese are looking at me. Says, uh-oh, what do we have here?
Mm-hmm.
No American would eat a chicken head.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy's eating a chicken head. So something's wrong. So I'm listening to the Vietnamese talk back and forth. And I didn't understand everything, but I got a gist of it. This guy has been in Vietnam before. And I said, "No, I haven't." And Captain Min spoke very good American,
mm-hmm.
been to quite a few courses in the States. He says, "Tom, how did you know what we were saying if you hadn't been here before?
Mm-hmm.
How did you know to eat the chicken head?" I says, "Look, I've been to Bragg. This is enough said."
Well, why were you rushed to the Mekong Delta? What was it that was going on there that required
Vietnamization.
Okay, an infusion of advisors. Vietnamization. When did you arrive there? You left in late 69, so was it early 70 by the time you got there?
Or March 70.
Right.
I think it was March.
What kind of briefings did you get when you arrived?
Didn't get shit.
Okay. Do you think they should have had something? Or did you really not require it?
I was J-46.
Okay.
I met the sergeant major.
Mm-hmm.
Met the General Maples.
Mm-hmm.
I was basically told, "You're going down here. You have a battalion. It's got five companies. They're located in this area of the Mekong Delta. All support for everything, ordnance support in the Mekong Delta belongs to you." And I guess I was there in Saigon 2 days,
mm-hmm.
down in the Mekong Delta.
Now, when you say you have a battalion, you're working with a battalion of Vietnamese?
Vietnamese.
That are running ordnance support throughout the Mekong Delta?
Yes.
And so you're advising a counterpart
yes,
a Vietnamese counterpart, who's actually the commander of the Arvin. This is an Arvin unit.
Yeah.
An Arvin unit.
On my team was myself and my boss was Major Cicello.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. We called him the Sicilo Man.
Okay.
S-Y-C-Z-Y-L-O, Cicello. Yeah. No. But, and his boss was the J-46, mm-hmm, in charge of all logistics for the Mekong Delta.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, we did not report to the general in charge of the area. We reported directly to Saigon. We did not report to General Cushman, and that pissed him off.
Yeah.
So I've been in very nice positions of not being liked.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you got to the Mekong Delta, first of all, we're in the Mekong Delta. It's a pretty large place.
Well, the headquarters was in Kanto.
Okay.
I had companies in My Tho,
mm-hmm,
Sok Trang, Long Xuyen, of course Kanto, I can't remember the other two locations. One was down around the Periks, around the Yumin, and the other one was up in the Plain of Reeds. I can't remember the cities.
Okay. What was the what was it like meeting your counterpart for the first time?
He was North Vietnamese.
Okay.
He had been trained at the. He was a graduate of the French Military Academy.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, he spoke very good French. And he was a very, very good officer. He was hard, but fair.
Okay.
Which is difficult to find.
Yeah.
The other lieutenant colonels I worked with, two of them are also ex-French military.
Mm-hmm.
One was ex-Viet Cong.
Okay.
Fighting the French.
Mm-hmm.
He was basically, I want to free Vietnam. I don't want anything other than French influence. But then when the communists, he says, time for me to get out. And he joined the South Vietnamese military. He didn't want anything to do with communists. I had, of my direct counterparts, I had maybe three or four of them that were ex-Viet Minh.
Okay.
Not Viet Cong, Viet Minh.
Mm-hmm. Fighting against the French.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, did many of them speak English or American?
I would say maybe... Of my direct reports, guys I worked with, maybe three or four of them, 30%.
Did you have interpreters, or were you just picking
up? I did not use interpreters.
Okay.
I found an interpreter. I got to the point I did not trust interpreters.
Okay.
Because an interpreter would tell them what he thought they should hear and not what I said.
Hmm.
So I became very very fluent in Vietnamese, and I got to the point I would correct interpreters.
Okay. Yeah, so it's at that point it's time to get rid of them.
Yes.
When you can start correcting them. Okay. What about your other advisors, the other men on your staff? How fluent did they become in Vietnamese?
Three of them were ex-Special Forces that were fluent in Vietnamese, French, and four or five of the other languages. It was it was interesting because we also supported the operations going on in Cambodia. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got to Cambodia, okay. The Vietnamese operations in Cambodia. Mm-hmm. Went to the Vinh Long ferry cross, not Vinh Long, what was it? That's no one's going to have to come to me. It was on the Basak River into mm-hmm. Cambodia. Can't remember the ferry crossing. I had a I had three platoons in there, almost a full company, that were in there for I guess 3 or 4 months.
No, was this before or after the official incursion?
Both.
Okay.
Because the official incursion was when the Americans went in there, but the Vietnamese were in there before that.
Right.
Also, the we were running. You might have seen articles in the newspapers where the Cambodians were being outfitted with the United States military equipment, radios, mm-hmm. weapons, and everything like that.
Right.
And they were being trained in down in Chau Duc. Well, guess who the gunrunner was?
Okay.
You got him.
Okay. They were pulling the Cambodians over to Chau Duc for training?
Yeah. We were.
Yeah.
Vietnamese were doing the training.
Yeah.
But say, let's say special forces were doing the instruction. We completely equipped them all, trained them all, and sent them back.
Mm-hmm. How effective do you think that program was?
The program would have been more effective if the goddamn politicians would have stayed out of it.
Okay. How did the politicians influence or negatively impact this program?
Well, it was you had reporters that were in Phnom Penh, mm-hmm. In Chau Duc, mm-hmm. in those areas, and they were seeing things moving. And it was being reported in the news, and all of a sudden you got guys that were of knowledge in politics saying that they were not of knowledge, mm-hmm. and denying everything, and all of a sudden the what was basically going on for the JCRC was almost brought to a halt. Because politicians got involved in it. If the, I go back and I'm probably reiterating, but if it had been left to the special forces and the well-trained advisors, it would have been all right. Because you know, we were not allowed to support the Cambodians. Mm-hmm. Because it was not politically correct. Mm-hmm. It could not be known that we were supporting Cambodia. It could not be known that we were supporting Laos, yeah. because we had made a Geneva agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what? Other people had made an agreement, and it was not worth the paper it was written on.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the goody-goody two-shoes, you know, there's guys out there that are running operations. They're doing intelligence gathering,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden, pull them all out. Don't support the special forces. Don't support the Hmong, the Bru, the Khin. Don't support the operations going on in Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, people are dying.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of good Vietnamese friends of mine today are probably dead,
mm-hmm.
because we did not honor our agreement. And to answer some questions you have not asked, there was no Agent Orange stored by the United States government, stored by the United States government in the Mekong Delta.
Okay.
It was stored by the Vietnamese government.
Okay. Well, it wasn't too long after you got there that they stopped spraying.
Yes.
The Americans stopped spraying.
Yes, the Americans stopped spraying. Correct.
Well, what was the greatest challenge you faced as an advisor working with this particular Vietnamese unit?
My Vietnamese are seeing all of these helicopters flying all over the place, and we need to go someplace. And okay, Tom, get us a helicopter and we'll go.
Yeah.
I said, well, you get a VNAF helicopter in here and we'll go on a VNAF helicopter. No. We don't want to fly on a VNAF helicopter. Well, then we'll go by road.
Why wouldn't they want to fly on a VNAF?
Pilots weren't that qualified.
Pardon?
VNAF pilot would not go into a hot area. An American pilot would go into a hot area.
Okay.
Yeah, you got these 19, 20, 21-year-olds, and they got the best toy that's ever been made anywhere, and they like to play with their toys. These VNAF guys, look, man, people are shooting them. Yeah, okay, go on. No way.
Yeah.
Education. It was, you know, a very simple thing, you know. Engines in 113s, the supercharger was breaking all the time. And it always broke right before they were going to go on maneuvers.
How convenient.
How convenient. So I'm sitting down with an old warrant of mine in a bar in Saigon. He was a Saigon guy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sitting up there with him. I said, how can I fix these damn things without pulling the engine? He says, well, Tom, what they're doing is there's a shaft in there about that long that they're breaking. He says, all you have to do is replace the shaft. I said, how do you do that? So he takes me down to the maintenance shop the next day, shows me how to unbolt the front of the supercharger, go in there with a magnet and pull that broken shaft out, put the other shaft in, and an hour, 2 hours, it's back on the road again. So he got me a whole bunch of these shafts, and I taught my Vietnamese how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a problem with the...
we're going back.
There was a problem with engines failures on the multi-fuel engines. And I'm talking with him, and I said, well, what is the problem? And all of a sudden, these engines are blowing black smoke. So I'm talking with the techs out of Rock Island, Illinois, and they said, well, what you got to do is replace the injectors. Don't replace the engine. So for 6 injectors, pull them out and replace them. You don't have to replace the engine.
Mm-hmm.
But they were replacing engines. Because they did not know. It was education.
Yeah.
And then it was teach them how to repair and rebuild the injector.
Okay.
So the challenge was not basically large military problems. It was education.
Mm-hmm. Basic things.
Basic things. It's like one of the things that is hammered into the head in Bragg is... if you give a man a fish, he will eat for one day. If you teach him to fish, he will eat every day. Same basic thing. Education.
Okay. Well, what about political issues back in the U.S.? And in particular, I failed to ask you questions about your return. When you came back in late 69... what was it like coming back into the U.S.? You know, what did you What kind of greeting did you have? Reception did you have at the airport? That kind of stuff.
My reception in San Francisco airport was interesting. I ran into a bunch of Hare Krishna.
Okay.
And I almost broke down laughing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you must understand. And it was hilarious. As far as anti-war, nothing.
Okay.
I'm never bothered by anybody.
Okay.
Small town, Illinois. Went into the VFW, American Legion.
Mm-hmm.
When I was growing up, this town of around 2,000 had probably 10 bars and 4 churches. When I got back, it probably had 4 bars and 10 churches.
Wow.
So, it was interesting.
Yeah. How were you received at the VFW?
I was raised there, and I grew up there, and I knew everybody, but it was, why aren't you guys winning this war?
Hmm.
And I said, well, why doesn't somebody let us fight it?
Okay. Was that, what did you think when you were hit with those kinds of questions?
The guys don't know what's really happening. All they know is what they're seeing on the television news. And you must look at this as the first time that actual footage was seen by the American people of what was going on. One of the things that George Bush Sr. did in the Desert Storm, he didn't let those bastards do that. There was not as much as, the guys out there taking actual footage of guys getting their ass blown away. And Desert Storm was, if it had lasted longer, the propaganda tool would have caused a problem there also.
Well, when you went back in 1970, did you keep track of what was going on back in the United States in terms of some of the political problems with Nixon's policies and things?
Well, I liked the football game.
Uh-huh.
National Guard 2, Kent State. Kent State.
Oh, God. Kent State incident.
Yeah.
What did you think about that?
The United States military was only supporting the government to stop terrorist activities. I can get very opinionative when we start talking about Hayden and Fonda.
Mm-hmm.
And I do not want to talk about those people.
You don't need to talk about them.
But I believe that psychological warfare
mm-hmm.
was carried out in the United States mm-hmm. very well. They did a very, very good job.
Mm-hmm.
And most likely, I feel that the psychological warfare came out of the Kremlin. Now, whether it's documented evidence, I don't have any. Opinionated evidence, vocal given to me by other persons, would lead me to believe that. But they did a very good operation. It was a very, very good operation. They did a good job of it. and it was very, very well operated, psychological and political warfare. They did a better job of it than the United States has done probably in history. But they did a very good job.
Did you receive any kind of PSYOPs training at Bragg before you went back as a, before you went over to the Mekong Delta?
Yes.
What did that emphasize?
Was it hearts and minds.
Chu Hoi and civic action?
Civic action, hearts and minds. Mm-hmm. You know, I was telling you about, we had to give classes.
Yeah.
The class I gave was on Buddhism.
Okay.
It was on if you, the actions that you do will determine how the actions of the people that you are working with.
Mm-hmm.
If you treat, you know, basically, if you treat the people fairly and you respect them, they will treat you fairly and respect you. Because, you know, on all type of operations, you must learn that the person that you are working with, that you is as intelligent as you are.
Mm-hmm.
He might not speak English. He might not read and write English. He might not even read and write Vietnamese. But here in this village, he knows everything.
Mm-hmm.
Because the government stops at the village gate.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to work with that village, sit down and work with the village elders.
Mm-hmm.
But I would go into villages without a weapon, and I knew the village was hostile.
Mm-hmm.
And my Vietnamese would tell me I was crazy. But I'd go in there anyway. Because there's... Basically, after time in Vietnam and everything, people knew who I was and where I was going. And I said, if you shoot at me, I will kill you. If you don't shoot at me, I'll leave you alone. All that they wanted to do was to raise their rice, raise their pigs, raise their family, and make a little money.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they wanted. But it was the other people that were doing their thing.
Mm-hmm.
I tell you, people didn't understand it. You know, majority of the people, especially, I don't know about I Corps, 2 Corps, 3 Corps, down in the Mekong Delta, they didn't give a shit. I don't care who's running the government. I don't care if it's communist. I don't care if it's Adolf Hitler. I don't care who it is.
Mm-hmm.
Just let me raise my rice.
Mm-hmm.
Let me raise my kids, my pigs. But all majority of the rice land in the Mekong Delta was controlled by Saigon Chinese.
Okay.
Out of Chulan.
Okay.
But the farmer did not control the rice that he was raising.
Mm-hmm.
These Chinese in Chulan were taking all the rice, taking all the money.
Mm-hmm.
So he's pissed off.
Yeah.
I'm doing all the work. And all of these guys in Saigon are taking all the money.
Yeah.
So let's look at insurrections throughout the world, and you got the same thing.
Yeah. Well, in terms of enemy activity, how much of it was at the time you were there, 1970? And when did you leave that tour?
September, October 71.
Okay. But for that year that you were there, 18 months, year and a half that you were there, how much enemy activity was there, and was it principally Viet Cong and VA, a mixture?
Very little in VA.
Okay.
Very little in VA. The NVA activities were over around the... Nui Han Sok, Nui Koda,
mm-hmm.
area, Chowduck,
mm-hmm.
the Planar Reeds,
mm-hmm.
in that area, along the Cambodian border. That's basically all there was. The rest of it was Viet Cong.
Was there a significant amount of activity in the area where you, where the battalion was, the Arvin Battalion?
It all depended on the time of the year.
Mm-hmm.
During the rainy season, there was nothing. During the dry season, there was. During the rainy season, all cargo had to be moved by boats, by sampans. And during the dry season, no problem moving cargo, troops, or anything. So if you control the canals, you control the movement during the rainy season.
Okay.
So during the dry season is when they had the most activities. And that's basically coming across the Cambodian border.
Any major offensives against that battalion?
Yeah.
Or is it mostly small unit?
Small unit.
Actions, small snipers, unit. That kind of stuff.
The the biggest problem my guys had probably had was their wives or
personal issues.
Personal issues, yeah, yeah. I lost 4 or 5 in an operation. Now, this is not a combat battalion. This is a support battalion.
Yeah.
I lost 4 or 5 in an operation around Rakja.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, it was, they ran over a landmine.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as direct contact, it's very little.
Okay. I'm going to pause this for a second. We've been talking. What I really want to. All right, this is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Mr. Tom Ross on the 28th of September 2002. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we are in the Ambassador Hotel in Bangkok, Thailand. So why don't we go ahead and continue with the discussion of your second tour in Southeast Asia, and this was the tour in Vietnam. And if you would, describe some of the challenges with regard to cross-branch communications and also then cross-cultural communications.
With the cross-branch communications, I was United States Army advisor working out of J-4-6 out of Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that we did was to work with the Vietnamization of the processes going on in Vietnam. There was, you know, my advisors would come to me. My counterparts would come to me and say, well, I need a helicopter to go to this place. And I would say, no, I cannot give you a helicopter. You have to get a Vietnamese helicopter to fly there. And usually what it was that the Vietnamese, the VNAF, would not fly, provide an aircraft, and we would go by road. Go into a location, and my Vietnamese counterparts would say, well, why don't we go in and sit down and talk with the provincial senior advisors and talk with them? And I said, well, no, let's go talk with the Vietnamese. And they preferred to talk to, the Vietnamese preferred to talk with the Americans because they could get more out of the Americans than they can get out of the Vietnamese. Because the Vietnamese and the provinces had a very limited budget,
okay,
where the American budget was basically looked at as being an open pocketbook. A large quantity of advisors that were sent down to us were people that had spent 2 months, 3 months in an American military organization. Up to 6 months, and they had not finished their 1 year tour. So they were being sent down to us in the Mekong Delta to be advisors, and they had very, very bad opinions of the Vietnamese. an advisor would come into my organization, and I would ask them what they thought of the Vietnamese. What do you think about the goddamn slopes? Mm-hmm. And they would say, oh, these goddamn Vietnamese. And I would basically have them on the next airplane out because they did not understand the customs, culture. They did not speak the language. They could not eat the food. And basically, they didn't have a steak or their bacon and eggs in the morning. They were not able to operate.
And if they showed that kind of negativity, then
if they showed that negativity, I had them out of there.
How many, in terms of a percentage, about how many guys would you turn away?
60%.
Okay.
Because if they were coming down from the American division, see, the first, the 25th, and all of that, it was basically they were, you know, it was during the Vietnamization process. Mm-hmm. These guys had not spent a year there, so we're going to take this guy and send him down to be an advisor. And they had not gone through Fort Bragg. They had not been trained. They did not speak the language. Mm-hmm. They did not know the customs. They did not know the culture. Mm-hmm. And it was basically, okay, we got this guy here in Vietnam. So he hasn't finished his tour. Well, let's send him down to be an advisor. And it was basically there was two trains of thought. There was the advisor train of thought, and there was the United States military train of thought. There was the MACV, and there was, you know, the other organizations. We said, well, we got a guy that hasn't finished his tour, wanted him to finish his tour, so we'll send him to be an advisor. Wasn't trained, didn't know anything. Best send him back to the States. Other problems that we had, were not only cross-cultural, was cross-organizational. Mm-hmm. An advisor could not communicate with the organization right next to him that happened to be an American organization. Mm-hmm. Because the American advisor had to communicate with the district, with the province, before he went to the American to give support, the American military to give support. So it added an hour, a day, a week to get the support. So finally, it was easier to do it your own way. During the Vietnamization process also, a lot of American military organizations had their funds cut and were not able to receive the support that they were receiving from the United States military, and they were said, they were told that you will receive the support from the Vietnamese. And the PBRs out of Bien Thuy were having problems with the pilots breaking the shafts on the superchargers going into the engines, and the Vietnamese military was supporting the same type of engine in a 113 armored personnel carrier. The Vietnamese Army was able to rebuild the supercharger. The Vietnamese Navy was not. Hmm. And through the work through the advisor network, which was not official, it was all back channel. None of it went through official network, because it went through official networks, it would have taken so long. Mm-hmm. So the Vietnamese Army was rebuilding the superchargers for the Vietnamese Navy. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of animosity. Mm-hmm. between the services. Whether it be United States military or Vietnamese military, there was the animosity built in on the communications.
Which would you say was the more challenging of the communication issues? Was it cross-branch or organizational, cross-cultural, or were they just unique challenges to each?
I was with J464A, Advisor Team 10. Mm-hmm. We reported directly to MACV headquarters. My boss, the team leader, was a full bull colonel. The senior advisor for the Mekong Delta was a two-star American general. Then we had Cords, which was John Paul Vann, and Colby and Willie. And then we had the Vietnamese 4th Corps senior commander. It was a competition going on between Cushman and Vann on who controlled the military in the 4th Corps, and the Vietnamese general was saying, I think this is Vietnam. You guys don't control shit? But as far as they were concerned, they did. General Cushman was a very fine general, but he did not like the idea about having military personnel in his 4th Corps region that did not report to him. Now, that included us guys from J46, the people that were in the MACV SOG did not report to him. They reported directly to Saigon. And the military organization that reported to General Cushman was basically the advisors, the direct advisors. But you would have in the provinces, you would have a provincial senior advisor that was military that reported to General Cushman. You would have a provincial senior advisor that was civilian and reported to John Paul Vann. And for some reason, we had J46 that did not report to Cords or to the 4th Corps senior. So there was a whole bunch of unorganized communications. Then you had the advisors for the white mice that did not report to Cords, that did not report to Cushman, that did not report to anybody, that reported to Langley, Virginia. And it was an unorganized process.
Were there other civilian advisors that you worked with other than those that advised the white mice? For instance, the PRU advisors, that kind of stuff. Did you have any interaction with them?
We supported all operations, but there was other organizations working on contract with the United States government, the Dynelectron people. I had two Dynelectron people in the organization. I also had maybe 5 to 10 Filipino people working with me that were on a contract, and I cannot remember the subcontractor out of the Philippines that was running the contract, but it was a Filipino contract, and they were Filipino advisors, civilian advisors, working in Vietnam, working for the United States government. They reported to me, but I do not know who they reported to. Now, that might sound a bit... they They reported to me, but who they worked for, I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe that's better clarification of that.
Was the Dynalectron people, what did they do with you?
They were highly qualified technicians.
In electrical power?
They were on heavy equipment, and we had one that was on the communications equipment.
Okay.
But basically, it was engineering equipment and communications equipment.
Okay.
Dynalectron gave us good support. And the Philippine military, even though it was very, very limited, uh-huh. gave us good support.
Huh. What was their role?
Advisory.
Okay.
They were running MILFAPs. You know what a MILFAP is?
No.
Okay, they were military medical teams that would go into a province mm-hmm. or into an area and provide medical support for that local area, okay. whether it be dental or medical or running checkups for the kids and everything like that. They did a very good job. MILFAPs did a very good job. Also, there was the United States military ran a process by which there was the OSPJ, Overseas Procurement Japan equipment that was brought into Vietnam in the 60s. That was given to Taiwan and to the Philippines for rebuild to support their own military equipment. So basically what the United States was doing was setting up a rebuild process in Taiwan and the Philippines. Now that equipment was being consolidated into Vietnamese holding areas and then transferred to the Taiwanese or the Philippines.
What kind of equipment was being?
Majority of it was trucks, mm-hmm. 3/4 ton, 2.5 ton, 5 ton.
Okay. Any weapons involved?
There was on occasions. The commander of the LSTs would ask for a gift of a weapon, mm-hmm. and he would be provided with a Chi-Com, SKS, CKC, mm-hmm. or whatever. But there was no directly transfer of weapons involved.
Okay. Anything else that you can recall about your tour in Vietnam that you wanted to talk about?
Food was good.
Oh, really? Was this native food or?
Well, being an advisor, maybe we talked about this yesterday, Steve, about my initiation party.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Where you ate
the chicken head, the chicken feet, and the chicken blood.
Right.
But there was other things that. Once they figured out that I could basically eat anything, there was the Chinese chicken eggs, which in Philippines is called the balut.
Okay.
It was basically a baby duck egg.
Uh-huh. A half-hatched duck egg?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Used to love to go to my counterpart to the Ba Sak restaurant. Which was a restaurant located close to the Ba Sak River. And we would go down there and have some of the finest locally raised rabbit. And then after a while, I started to think, I had not seen a rabbit in the Mekong Delta. And so I questioned my counterpart about what kind of rabbit is this?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it has a long tail. I said, oh, you mean rat.
Yeah. Not floppy ears. Pointy ears.
Oh, he says, same, right? Yeah. Okay, same. Also, there was the introduction to the Vietnamese Chinese medicine. I was having a back problem. And Major Fong said that I should try the Vietnamese medicine type to take care of it. And so what kind of pill is it? He said, well, no pills. So what it was they would take a small glass bottle that looked like it's very, very small.
Mm-hmm.
And they would put a small piece of paper in it and light it and put it on your back. And it would cause a vacuum.
Yeah, that's cool.
And suck all the poison out of your body.
Oh, okay.
And I had about 24 of these on my running up on each side of the backbone. And I did not have a back problem. It cured my back problem.
Wow.
But it was Vietnamese Chinese medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked. Other interesting things that we did. I'm going to have a advisor team party. So Captain Min says, well, let's go to Rup Cha, which was 60 miles away through not nice area, and let's buy some lobster.
Hmm.
So we took the Jeep, Captain Min, myself, and two military with us. We went over to Rock Jaw and brought lobster and brought it back,
mm-hmm.
and we had a lobster party for the team. Another funny story. There was a problem in Vietnam. There was no Budweiser. They had Pabst Blue Ribbon and Ballantine beer. And they were old rejects out of the United States that were sent to Vietnam. So, due to the fact that I had the only heavy track laying equipment in the Mekong Delta, I was asked to destroy it.
How did you destroy it?
I showed the PX where I was running, crushing the cans with track laying equipment. And I took about 80 pallets of it, and we had a good tent party. But it turned out, I found out why it was contaminated, because all my Vietnamese got sick because they couldn't drink the goddamn beer. It was that bad. And I believe there was a Sergeant Major Woolridge involved into it off his yacht out of Hong Kong.
I've heard of him.
There was no corruption in the NCO clubs.
All the funds were properly used.
Properly managed.
How did your perceptions change over time as you were an advisor? You mentioned that you had started thinking more like on the Vietnamese side of things.
Well, it was one of these basic things that by living with the Vietnamese, by working with the Vietnamese, I started to understand the Vietnamese way of thinking about this. I became Vietnamese. Everybody was wanting the Vietnamese to become American instead of going and saying the other way around, when the Vietnamization programs, the advisors, should become more Vietnamese. And It got to the point of where I would go in and say, well, the Vietnamese need certain pieces of equipment. They need this. And it would be that it was not in accordance with what the United States military, United States government thought Vietnamization was. Mm-hmm. And all the equipment that was left over after the United States military left was given to the Vietnamese. So it wasn't maintained. It was a piece of shit. So we'll give this piece of shit to the Vietnamese to take care of. It was even into 71, it got into the point of let's cut back our support. Let's get away from the support of the Vietnamese. Let's get away from the support of the Oriental. And it wasn't only Vietnam. It was, we don't support Laos because of the Geneva Convention. There was no looking into what was actually going on the ground in Laos. It was that those Americans that were there were not there. And if they are there, it was a lot like there was a TV series in the States at that time. We'll give you the mission, but we will deny all.
Oh, Mission Impossible.
Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
Mission Impossible. And that's what it was. It was a Mission Impossible. You got a job to do. If you do your job, fine. No recognition. If you don't do your job and you get caught, we don't know you. And it was Mission Impossible. That Mission Impossible TV series was so much a picture of what we were doing here in Southeast Asia. We were working with the Lao. We were supplying the Lao. We were working with the Cambodians. We were supplying the Cambodians, but I was providing military equipment to the Cambodians, and the equipment that we were supplying was so covered up, it went from the United States military to Europe, to Greece, to Turkey, to God knows who else. Then it came to Vietnam. It was transferred from the Americans to the Vietnamese, to the Americans to the Vietnamese, mm-hmm. all to lose all of accountability trail. There was no accountability for the equipment that was provided to the Cambodians.
Is this part of the MET-T program?
It's part of JCRC.
Okay. Did you ever work with the General Metaxas on that, with the Cambodians?
Yes. I was recommended by General Maples to work for General Metaxas, and the branch said no. The operations that were going on with Metaxas, I feel sorry for those guys because their hands were tied. Their hands were flat tied. Out of J4, due to the fact that material that came into us was no paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
And it went straight from us as the advice, it was transferred from the Vietnamese mm-hmm. to us mm-hmm. as J4.
Okay.
But we there was no paperwork trail. We'd pick it up off the trucks, deliver it to Shithooks, fly it to Chowduck, fly it to Nuklung Ferry Crossing. That was the ferry crossing in Cambodia. I couldn't remember. Yep. Nuklung Ferry Crossing. We'd fly it in there, offload it. We would stay for hours, days. Longest there was maybe 2 weeks. And transfer the equipment. But whether it came out of the actual transfer, who took credit for it, who did it, I don't know. But it was all to support the Cambodians. And this was in late 70, early 71. Mm-hmm. Had to be around that time. Because we were, the Cambodians were being trained there at the Chowduck Training Center. And I was, an interesting thing. I was given two Cambodian decorations that is not on my 214 that I am not allowed to wear because we weren't there.
Yeah.
And I have Lao decorations that I'm not allowed to wear that are not on my 214 because we weren't there.
Well, what was your primary source of news in Vietnam? Was it the same as in Thailand, Stars and Stripes?
Stars and Stripes and Armed Forces Radio.
Oh, yeah.
AF, Armed Forces Radio Vietnam. And had another good source. The best source of military information we had was from Hanoi Hana.
Okay. So you listened to those broadcasts out of Hanoi?
Oh, yes. It was hilarious.
Okay.
It was. If a guy was in a regular United States military unit, it scared the shit out of him.
Yeah.
But here we are, advisors, and it's funny.
Yeah.
It's a joke.
Yeah.
But they did a good job. The intelligence warfare, the political warfare that was done by the North Vietnamese and their supporters was a very good job. They did a very good job. Matter of fact, it should be used as training material in Bragg. Because they did a good job on their PSYOPs. PSYOPs operation running out of Vietnam and their supporters was very good.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you corresponding very much with family back home, your mom?
Yes.
Was she sending you information about what was going on back there?
No. I was in the hospital for a couple of days. And my mother sent me a birthday cake. Right, through the mail, an angel food cake. Two cans of icing packed in popcorn. It comes in, I'm in the hospital, and the nurses decided that it was not proper hospital food. So guess who ate? The nurses.
That's wrong.
No, it wasn't. It was. No. And they would bring it. This is your mother's angel food cake. I would eat it. My guys would come in on the team. And the nurses were second lieutenants, first lieutenants, captains, and they had the goddamn majors and lieutenant colonels. But I'm sitting there, and my team would come in. We're bringing flowers for the captain. And he would go right past the major, right past the colonel. Oh, it's nice, they're bringing flowers. There's a fifth of scotch in it. And the lieutenants and the captain, okay, that's where he's getting his booze. It's through the flowers that these guys are bringing in. So I had a birthday party. The nurses had a birthday party for me. It was my mother's angel food cake, scotch, beer, and whatever. And it was a good birthday party.
Okay, so they shared it.
Yeah, they shared it.
When you first said the nurses ate it, I thought you meant they ate it all and they wouldn't share it. I was going to say that's wrong. As long as they shared it. Was the treatment good in the hospital?
I found the treatment in the Army medical facilities to be very good. There was times that the guys were, shot and wounded, and they got them out, medevaced them out. He's shot, wounded, 15 minutes later, and he's in a medical facility. 2 days later, he's sitting in Japan. Good. That was the only war at that time where they were able to get sick and wounded out rapidly. They did a good job of it.
In terms of the other activity that you were involved with in Vietnam, were you ever short of any particular material or equipment?
I had no problem with toilet paper in Vietnam.
Good. How about other stuff? Essential. Well, not that toilet paper is essential, but true essentials for survival in combat.
If I ran short of anything, I went to the United States military and got it.
Okay.
I had a signature card for the LBJ scrapyard. And on numerous occasions, I would run up to the LBJ scrapyard, which was the PDO, property disposal yard, and pick up things. There was an orphanage in between Kantol and Bintui that was run by Catholic missionaries that needed materials. And I went up to PDO and got 200 complete bed sets, ration cans, everything for the orphanage.
Okay.
And then I, within 2 weeks, I'm in Cambodia and came back and find out that the Catholic priest sold everything.
They sold it?
They sold it.
Why?
And the kids didn't get shit.
Why did they sell it?
They were taking the money for themselves. Other occasions, at the same time, I brought in to build dormitories for the kids. I brought in 2 40-foot truckloads of cement, and the kids didn't get anything. It was all sold.
That's a shame.
One of the most enjoyable things that happened, it was during the Tet, I guess it was 70 or 71, that Major Sicello says, well, we need to get presents for our kids. And we had a battalion, and these guys had wives, and they had kids. So we need to get things for our kids. They were all our kids. So I don't know how he did it, but about a month before Christmas, we got airplane loads of toys and candy and clothes. So here comes the Tet, New Year's, and we're running all over the Mekong Delta with 2.5-ton truckloads of toys for the kids. And it was fun. It was like, you know, they didn't know what Santa Claus was. But right here comes these, all these Americans. And I would send one of my sergeants out to one base, one company, with all these toys and everything like that. He'd be passing out toys to the kids. And it was fun.
Now, were the Vietnamese involved with that?
Of course. Because the sergeant would go in, but it was all arranged by the Vietnamese. And it was not that the Americans were giving it. The Americans were not doing it. It was that this was presents being delivered that came in, that the Americans received, but they didn't know where they came from. And they were just bringing them down in the trucks. It was all of the it was almost the Phuong Long. The Phuong Long brings death and also brings good works. And this is the Phuong Long bringing good works. And that was enjoyable.
Now, did you go on any R&Rs from Vietnam?
Yes.
Where'd you go?
Bangkok and Australia.
How enjoyable was that? Both of them. How did it?
Well, Bangkok, I was basically coming home to Thailand.
Okay.
Australia was interesting.
Okay. What made it interesting?
I walked off that plane, a poor, dumb little soldier coming out of Vietnam, and there was a pair of hot pants asking me, where did I want to go?
Wow.
And I went to the Outback in Australia with this girl for a week, staying on her father's sheep farm. And it was interesting.
And while you were there, were there any USO shows? Or did the USO packed up pretty much?
Oh, no. I've got photographs of us sitting on top of a 40-foot crane with a basket hanging underneath the crane at the USO show in Korat.
Mm-hmm.
With Bob Hope.
Oh, okay. So Bob Hope show.
Oh, yes.
How important was that? Psychologically, morale.
Bob Hope's good people. He brought in a lifesaver. And now, anybody tries to do it now, not Bob Hope. They cannot do a Bob Hope show.
Okay.
You know, what was the name of the damn woman?
Raquel Welch, Jan Margaret.
No. Comedian, big mouth.
Oh.
Imogene Coca.
Okay.
She comes in, says, I want to go out with you guys tonight. Don't think so. Yeah, I'm going to go out with you guys tonight. I don't think so. Look, son, I'm telling you, I'm going out with you guys tonight. You going out for a walk tonight? I'm going with you. I don't think so. Look, sonny, I'm going for a walk tonight with you. And she went on a mission.
Wow.
Of course, we made sure there was nothing that happened. Right? We brought the lady back. And she said, okay, now I know what it's like. Imogene Coca, Rusty Warren. Big mouth women. And sit down, and Imogene Coca would sit down there and go shot on you, shot on shot.
That's scary.
But as far as she was concerned, we were her kids.
Well, did you feel that way when you came back to the United States after your second tour?
Basically, again, I'm saying I had no troubles.
When did you leave in 71? What time period was that? Must have been...
In the 71.
Okay.
October, yeah, October, November.
Okay.
It was... And I went into San Francisco, picked up the Pantera, went to see my mother, and went down to Texas, and then went to Fort Campbell. It was no problem.
Okay.
But there was... If there was animosity in the air, I did not see it. And small town Illinois, there was nothing.
Now, when you came back to the United States, where was your next assignment?
101st Airborne Division.
Fort Campbell.
We first went into Fort Bliss, Texas for desert training, and then to Campbell. And this was in the 70s, and we're going through desert training. So somebody was planning ahead a little bit.
What? How much longer did you have in the military? Did you decide that you were going to get up?
No.
I
was going to stay. I was going to be a lifer.
Okay. When did you realize that you weren't going to be a lifer?
In July of 74, I called branch, office personnel, operations, and asked them what my next assignment was. I had been around 18 months, 101st Airborne Division. They had laid out a process for me. I was going to go into the FAST program, Foreign Area Specialist Training Program, and reassigned to Thailand for 5 years of the embassy. About 2 weeks, a month later, I received a pink slip. Reduction in forces.
Yeah.
Okay. To say the least, I was slightly pissed off.
Yeah.
When the colonel called me in and told me that I had been rifted, I said, well, excuse me, sir, you must be joking. I don't believe this. And he says, well, why you have been rifted, I don't know. No, you cannot find out why you have been rifted. Nobody will give you any information on why you have been rifted. Maybe I can find out now by the Freedom of Information Act, but probably it was that there was just too damn many officers and had to get rid of some. Whether it was threw a dart to a dartboard or pulled it out of a hat or whatever it was, makes no difference. But,
so you had a sudden version ahead of that version of it?
Yes.
Well, for the last year and a half that you were in, where you were with the 101st, Well, how would you describe morale in that unit?
When I took over the unit, the 101st had just been reactivated. The unit I took over was HMS 801st, okay. Headquarters of Main Support, 801st Maintenance Battalion.
Okay.
They had a 25% AWOL rate.
25%?
AWOL rate.
Good God.
Doing an analysis of what was the AWOLs, it was basically 9 people that were going AWOL, okay. Coming back on the 29th day, the 30th day, they're a deserter. Mm-hmm. And they would go back AWOL again. So I got a telephone call from Flushing, New York, saying to me that they had picked up this private of mine that was AWOL. You want us to send him back by bus? No. Don't send him back. I will have somebody pick him up and bring him back. And I had Master Sergeant George Cuthbert Harris go pick him up. George Harris was White Star. He was Frozen Chosen Korea. He was an old sergeant from the Brown Boot Army. And Harris went down and got a .45 Colt and a 12-gauge shotgun and chains and brought him back. And I think Harris every hour says, run, run, let me shoot you. Kid didn't run, the kid didn't go AWOL again. But that put out the word. And all of a sudden, I went from 20% to no percent AWOLs.
How about drug use?
Drug problem was not in the United States. Drug problem was in Vietnam. Had a drug problem in Vietnam. Drugs were freely available out of Ben Samui and Canto. Mm-hmm. They were marijuana, and they were doing hard drugs. Marijuana, I did not consider to be a problem.
Okay.
They were running hard drugs. There was a lot of heroin coming in. And this is, again, this was a way of warfare that was done by the Vietnamese or their supporters against the Americans, bringing in drugs. Drugs were freely available. And I will say again, I do not consider marijuana to be a drug.
You're talking about heroin principally.
The heroin, the opium.
All the opium derivatives.
There was even, depending on where you went to in the Ben Samui area, mm-hmm. Ben Samui is new bus station in Vietnamese, at the bar area in Canto, there was laced cigarettes being passed out. You go in and say, oh, give me a cigarette, and it would be a lace. In the 101st, went out for a combat qualification, and brigade says, well, you guys will set up your location in this area. And I went in there and I told the brigade commander, I said, I really don't think I should put my troops into this area because the area is chemically contaminated. And this is in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Kentucky-Tennessee border. And the brigade commander says, why? I said, well, let me take you out there and show you why it's contaminated. It was right in the middle of some guy's marijuana farm. And the colonel didn't know what he was looking at.
Well, as you were getting close to your time, the end of your time in service, after your IFNOS, what were your plans? What were you going to do? Did you have any ideas?
I had no fucking ideas. They gave me 90 days.
Okay.
I sent off job applications for a couple of months. I became a professional liar, called an insurance salesman. And to be an insurance salesman, you must be a professional liar. I was unemployed, minorly employed for about 6 months, and I got a telegram from Bendix the Ankle offering me a job in Saudi Arabia. And I told them they were crazy. So 2 months later, they sent me another fax and offered me the same job back in Saudi Arabia. And I said, okay, I'll go to Saudi Arabia.
What did you do for them?
I was the chief of records and analysis branch for the National Maintenance Point for the Saudi military.
How long did you do that?
2 years.
Well, then, that would have been the 73-75 time frame. Is that correct?
No. 74-76.
Okay. Well, what did you... When
September 73 rifted.
Okay, September
May 74.
Okay.
Saudi.
Okay. What did you think in 1973 when the United States... signed the Paris Peace Accords and ended American involvement in Southeast Asia?
Traitors. I thought and still think that politicians had sold out people that trusted us. And the United States government could not be trusted. Any agreement the United States government made could not be trusted. We sold out people, we sold out ourselves, and as far as I was concerned, that we were a bunch of traitors to ourselves and to the people that we supported.
Okay.
That might be difficult for some people to understand, but
what did you think? I assume that emotion, that feeling, carried over in 75 when Saigon fell.
The guy I was working with in 75 in Saudi Arabia was a external nine electron person. He had his wife and kids, Vietnamese wife, Vietnamese kids, sitting in Vietnam, and all of a sudden he's hearing that over the Voice of America and everything like that, that the Saigon's falling, and he just, I'm leaving. I'm going back to Vietnam. I got to get my kids out. I got to get my wife out. Whether they ever got out or not, I don't know. It was one of these things that, drinking of alcohol or possession of alcohol in Saudi Arabia is against the law. Myself and about five other ex-military personnel sat down in my room and Saudi military friends of ours brought by over a case of scotch. We sat down and we did the old special forces twist the top, throw the top in the trash can, pass the bottle. But it comes back to me, that motherfucker better be empty. And we sat down and talked. Why? It was not that the United States had lied to the Vietnamese. It was that everything that we had been doing for 10, 15, 20 years. Mm-hmm. Harris, White Star, Willie Foster, first black man in Special Forces. White Star, other operations. Look, why? You know, why? What? It's not the United States that's killing us. It's the damn politicians. And you know, this whole thing now is it's going to be killed by politicians, because how can somebody spend millions of dollars to run for office, to get a job, but they're only going to spend, they're only going to receive $100,000. Just don't understand.
Well, what were the important things that you took away from your Vietnam War experience that, in your time in Thailand as well, that you were able to apply to your life early on in, say, in Saudi Arabia, or even shortly thereafter?
Understand a person as a person. If they are doing something that you do not understand, why are they doing it that way? Mm-hmm. Management under the Harvard and Yale business practices, I feel, is incorrect. To be able to manage, is you don't sit behind a desk in an office. You get up and you walk. Mm-hmm. And you talk. You go in, and if there is an operator doing a menial job, she might be putting a screw into a widget. And you sit down, and you walk by, and you're putting a screw in a widget. Can that be done better? And that person will tell you how better to do the job. Not the engineer, not the supervisor, not her manager. She will tell you, or he will tell you, how to do it better. The whole thing taught me is that to be more people-oriented, to be able to go down. I've been presidents of companies, managing directors of companies, and I must reiterate that this has all been outside the United States.
Yes, this is in Thailand principally?
Thailand, Saudi Arabia, but in Thailand for the last 15 years. An interesting story. Who knows the best about quality? It's that operator there on the floor. I was working for AT&T here at AT&T Micro. And Arascov, which at that time was the CEO, this was in 85, Arascov is coming through for a visit. And the Thais had told the operators, do not shut down anything for any reason, or you'll be fired. So we're going through SAW, through Diatach, through Wirebond, going into the mold area, and they're running the old type hand molding systems, running the, can't remember what the mold was, but this girl sees a problem with the packages that are coming out. She sees a quality problem. She hits the red button. Red button, red lights going off all over the place. Sirens going all over the place. Everything is stopped. Process is stopped. Guy says, she's fired. Ariscog asked the president of the AT&T Thailand, what happened? And he said, well, and he asked me, he said, well, what happened? I said, well, let's go over and talk to the girl. And Ariscog, the CEO of AT&T, goes over and is talking to low-class lady. She was making maybe, at most, she was making maybe $50 a month. And here's the CEO of AT&T talking to a $50 a month employee. And I ask her, what was the problem? And she pulls it out. She says, there is a void on this IC. I will not let any quality problem go out of my station. No quality problems go past me. I stop it. This is a $50 a month girl that would not let a quality reject pass her. The factory manager had been with AT&T since World War II, 35 years in Reading, Virginia. Ariscog was wearing a gold triangle, the AT&T highest award for quality. He took it off and gave it to the $50 per month prayer. Because she knew more about quality than he did.
Impressive. Impressive.
That factory has no quality rejects.
No, this factory is
in Thailand.
Here in Thailand.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, when did you decide to come back to Thailand on a permanent basis?
In 1980, late 84, I had a radio in my where I lived. I was able to receive Air Force frequencies. And I'm listening to it, and there's an AWACS up there saying there is F-4s taking off out of Adaman, four of them. They're coming towards Saudi Arabia. It appears that they are heading towards Ras Tanura. There was that's four bogeys coming out of Bottom Bun. There was bodyguards on the AWACS. Bodyguards peeled off, took out three of the F-4s. One F-4 boogied back. They came back in, back on bodyguard. About that time, the Saudis took off out of Tehran, and the Saudis were credited with the kills. And I figured, well, I've seen enough of this. About time for me to leave.
Okay.
I was carrying a TS. I was the There was only two certified logisticians in Doha and Aramco, and myself and another person, certified logisticians. And it took me a while to convince the Saudis to release me. And my Saudi TS clearance came from the time when I was working with Bendex Yankel with the Thai military. So I carried a TS until the time I left,
okay.
A Saudi TS. That caused me some nice times and some bad times. Because I was carrying a TS, I was allowed to go in. I was required to go into classified areas in the oil industry and retrieve information for the Saudi government. They did not know where anything was. It was... The oil companies kept a lot of things very, very tight to them and did not give out the information. And I was carrying a Saudi TS clearance, and I was taking information off the computer system and providing it to Yamani, to Bandar, and to Saud.
And... But ultimately, you made the decision to leave that and come to Thailand on a permanent basis.
Yes.
What led you to that conclusion? You wanted to come and become a permanent resident in Thailand.
I had a Thai girlfriend.
Okay. That'll help.
This is a lady that I had known since 68. I came here... And we fell out, and then I met my present wife,
okay.
And we got married.
Yeah, we were talking before we actually started conducting this interview. You expressed some discontent with the American government in terms of the policies in Southeast Asia. And I was wondering if you would explain how that factored into your decision not to go back to the United States and live there, but you decided that you wanted to stay here in Thailand and become a resident of Thailand.
Well, it's not exactly that I wanted to become a resident of Thailand.
Oh, okay.
It was that I was very unhappy with the way... It was. I was dissatisfied with the way the United States government and the politicians sold out the people that trusted them. Whether this be Tricky Dicky or Harry S. Kissinger, I find Kissinger to be a prevaricator. I must reiterate that this is a personal opinion,
yes.
That I find him not to be conducive to the support of America. Personal opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people in offices in the United States should be Americans and not be derivatives of yesterday they were whatever, now they are politicians in the United States. I'm trying to be nice. I think that Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, especially Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam were sold out by agreements that were made by Harry Kissinger. A lot of my friends, a lot of our friends died because of political movements that was done by politicians to cover their own personal problems. You must remember that right at this time also that there was the problems with Watergate and everything else. So everybody was covering their ass and the hell with the goddamn people over here in Southeast Asia. Personal opinion. It was that, it got to the point that the advisors and the special forces were looked down on by United States military personnel, high-ranking military personnel, because we were not we were not regimented. We did not follow the exact code that was supposed to be followed. We were not we were bastards. We did not go by the book. And all of a sudden, it was, everything that Eisenhower had been saying about the domino theory was lost. It was CYA. Everybody was running paperwork assholes and covering their ass with paper instead of getting the goddamn job done. That's why. I got tired of it. I love America. I am an American. I am probably more of an American than a lot of the other people that are still there running in politics and saying they're Americans. Mm-hmm. My family has been in the United States, been an American since 1619. Jamestown. Mm-hmm. But it is... I disagree with the way politics is run then. Mm-hmm. The politicians love to run their mouth because they think people will listen. It is much better to do it the Oriental way, is to keep your mouth shut and listen and do. An empty container makes the most noise. If you put a rock in an empty beer can and shake it around, it makes all kinds of noise. A lot of our politicians are empty beer containers with rocks inside.
Well, what have you thought about normalization of the relationship between the United States and Vietnam in particular?
Should have been done a long time ago. Yeah. Again, people are saying that the Vietnamese killed Americans. Well, politicians killed Americans, not Vietnamese. Vietnam is a very, very beautiful country and with very, very beautiful, warm-hearted people. Wars are not caused by people. Wars are caused by politicians, and soldiers die because politicians cannot get off of their egos to realize that it's not necessary.
Have you felt, as an American living in Thailand, have you felt that the Thai people have been very open and accepting of you as a member of their community, the nation? Or have you met resistance sometimes?
Resistance. An interesting word. I pull up to a toll booth, and the police officer says that I ran a stoplight, so he has to charge me a fine for running a stoplight. And I tell him, well, I didn't run a stoplight. He says, well, yes, you did. Of course, he was not in any way to see that I ran a stoplight or did not run a stoplight. So basically, it was payday, Friday, the end of the month. So okay, basically, it was a donation. So I give him $2.50 donation. Uh, 25 years ago, Cook County, Chicago, driving a Pantera to Tomaso. I drive by a police car, the lights go on, I pull over. You were speeding. $25. Would you like to join the police, the Cook County Police Protective Association? I join, there's no fine. And I also make another $100 donation to get tickets for the policeman's ball. Everywhere in the world is the same. I am a permanent resident of Thailand. There is only 100 permanent residents per nationality per year that can be authorized. When I received my permanent residence, there had only been two Americans at that year that applied to be permanent residents. And the permanent resident I was going on was a family one, family permanent resident, which was about $1,000 at that time. And I was recommended by the immigration department that I should apply for a business permanent resident instead of a personal permanent resident. And I said, well, I agree with you. And that was $2,000. So I applied for the business permanent residence, which it required that signatures be signed that I had donated, I had invested $10 million into Thailand. And I received the signatures that I had invested $10 million in Thailand. And I paid a $2,000, and now I have a permanent residence. Are you going to ask me how much I really invested?
Yep.
About $1.99.95. No, I had been worked with development projects. I had invested not in, to include the house and the land and everything like that. Maybe $100,000.
This is personal money that you invested.
Yeah. With the personal money I invested in my house, my car.
It was your stuff.
Yeah, my stuff.
Yeah. Okay.
But.
But that, you can still hide under that fig leaf.
Yes. Okay. And the rest of it was signatures by friends, police generals, Air Force, Supreme Commanders, yeah.
To have enough political clout on that application, so it wouldn't be questioned.
Right. They told me it would take a year to process it, and a week later, I went down and picked it up.
Well, what's been your greatest challenge as an American living abroad, an American living in Thailand?
It's almost to the point that I don't know. I have, like we said before, Steve, I have culture shock when I go back to the States. Those guys in the States drive on the goddamn wrong side of the road. I go to a gas station here, and I step out, give them the car keys. And they pump the gas, they clean the windows, they check the oil, they check the tires.
You're still service-oriented.
Service-oriented. Supposedly, the United States is not a manufacturing country any longer. It's now a service-oriented country. And the service-oriented orientation is between the lawyers and the accountants. And I say, yeah, right, okay. I was talking to some friends the other day, and it was brought up that to be an FBI, you must either be an accountant or a lawyer. And I says, Jesus Christ, is that what we're depending upon?
Well, in a broad sense, what do you think is the most important thing the United States as a nation should take away from its experiences in Southeast Asia?
There was a lot of understanding that was came out of, you know, everybody says, well, we spent 10, 15, 20 years in Vietnam. No, we did not. We spent 21 year of understanding of what was going on in Vietnam. One of the things that is not understood, not only by the United States, but by all governments, is that you must understand the people that you are working with. And to be able to understand the people, you got to be able to communicate with people. You cannot be sending in State Department people and other people to work in the embassy that are not able to communicate. Very interesting. This week, mm-hmm. an American person that is married to a Thai woman. Mm-hmm. He's retired. He is retired from the United States, and he is semi-wealthy. He is married to a Thai lady. They have a child. He went down. He's going to take his on vacation, take his wife back to the United States to meet his father. His father is 90 some odd years old. And they got in line at 7 o'clock in the morning to go into the embassy to process it. They were first 10 in line. 2 hours later, they are still in the process problem. Oh, this much was done. Okay, come back tomorrow. They go back the next day. Well, okay, this is all done. Now stand in line to go pay your money for this process. And she must come back the next day at 2 o'clock in the afternoon to go through an interview. So she goes back there, and they give an entrance visa for 2 months. Fine. I explained to him that the entrance visa is for her to go to the United States. Within the next 2 months, she goes to the United States. Comes back. If she reapplies again, she'll probably get one for the life of the passport. But the bureaucracy, 3 days standing in line, and it's an American. What is it for this Thai trying to get a business visa to go to the United States, or for a student? You know, my wife is very lucky. She went back to Stanford to get her master's degree. Mm-hmm. But she was lucky because I was ex-military, because I knew people and got all the bullshit, all the bullshit stopped. But if it was somebody else, you know, this, you probably heard about there's two different types in the State Department. There's steers and queers. I haven't seen any horns lately. But Ambassador Ito did a very good job. I met Ito. This is right during the trial of O.J. Simpson. He says, my name is Ambassador Ito, and I am in no relationship to Judge Ito. I want everybody to understand that. Right. I am in no relationship to Judge Ito.
Right. Well, how about things that are more specific to the Vietnam War itself and the way the U.S. conducted the war? What lessons should we take away from that?
Keep the politicians out of it. Going to today, because there's an election coming up for the Senate and for the House, everybody is doing this upmanship and come on, let's just get the job done. It's that the president should apologize to the Democratic Party for what? Just get up off your ass and do the job. Republican Party, get up off your ass and do the job. You guys were elected to do a job. Do the job. Stop all of this erroneous bullshit. You know, there are things that the United States members of government do that if you and I did it, we would be in jail and the key would have been thrown away a long time ago. It would be like the military saying that we'd be so far in jail we'd have to pump sunlight to us. And I want to mention Chappaquiddick. Because oh, I don't want to mention anything about RMK, BRJ, or Sealand Van Line. You know about those?
Sealand.
One of the largest investors in Sealand was Lady Bird Johnson.
Oh, yes, I have heard about this.
Investors.
Right. We've benefited specifically from the war.
Well, they were the only one allowed to take in containers,
right.
But
right.
And Bell Helicopter is located in Texas. And RMK BRJ is the only construction consortium allowed to do any building in Vietnam. And Alpha Tech and PA&E. And all of it was on the blood of somebody else's life. That's also part of why.
You saw,
you know,
excessive corporate profits resulting from the war.
I seen people that were not allowed to have food to eat because they were not Catholic. I seen people in Mito that were starved because the Saigon government was being run by Catholics and these were not Catholics, and because I went out and got food and rice and pork and pigs and fed the people, I came very close to deep putting. What deep putting is, it's deep shit. Because I went against the Saigon government. And I was an advisor. I can do that.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about today? We've covered a lot of ground.
Yeah, we did. Yes. I waited until I was 45 years old to get married. Mm-hmm. I came back to Thailand, went to work for AT&T. Mm-hmm. There was a young lady there that had got her bachelor's degree in Thai history from Rongsit University. And 4 years later, we got married. And now I have a 9-year-old mm-hmm. and a 7-year-old. And I'm glad I waited till I was 45.
Okay. Any reason in particular?
I was having too much fun.
Okay.
You know, in Aramco, they gave you a one-way ticket mm-hmm. every year. I was a GS-15, mm-hmm. and they gave me a one-way ticket every year. Around the world, first class, anywhere I wanted to go for 45 days. And when I came back, they gave me a 30-day bonus for coming back. Saudi Arabia is not an easy place to live. And a lot of the problems that everybody is saying right now is caused by Islam. It's not caused by Islam. Islam has nothing to do with it. It's people. And back to the old story. Liberate the oppressed. Educate them. Pay them fairly. Give them a good job. And you will have no problems. The biggest problem is education. Educate the people. Give them the right to make a mistake. Empower them to do a job. Don't give them a job and tell them what to do. Empower them to do the job. Give them the responsibility of making a decision. Whether it's wrong or right. Give the person the power to make a mistake and don't punish them if they make a mistake. Different, right, Steve? It's called empowerment. Empower the people to make a decision. That's what I learned in the 35 years I've been running all over the world. Because you must. If a person sits there and does something and makes a mistake, no problem. If the person sits there and doesn't do shit, get rid of them. You don't need them in your organization. If they come to you and say, I want to do this, this, and this, what do you think? I will never tell them what to do. What I do is I say, you must look at if, then, else. And it's simple logic, if, then, else. Look at it. Evaluate the situation and make a decision. The decision you make is incorrect, I don't care. Unless it really adversely affects my bottom line. But if it really adversely affects my bottom line, that's my fault. That's not that person's fault. My fault because I let it go that far. Because everything is the bottom line. Did you ever read the book The Goal?
Yeah.
Find it. It's a good book. The goal, there's only one goal, the bottom line. The bottom line is an accounting principle. And people go out spending millions of dollars to improve the bottom line, and they did not do the if, then, else. They did not do the basic analysis. The whole thing, personal opinion, the whole thing going on with Iraq right now, let the Kurds do it. Empower them to do their own goddamn job. Give them the ability to do it and let them do it. And stay out of it. Rattling sabers only makes noise. The more politicians talk too much. Don't need to talk, just do it. Don't want to hear about it, just do it. Very simple. You got a problem, fix it. Get the job done. Bush is trying to push that way, but being a politician and everybody else being politicians are running their mouths too much. Just let the Kurds do it. Just leave them alone. Just, okay. Let's bring your boys over down here to Bragg.
Train them, equip them.
Okay. You need supplies. You need helicopters. Okay, no problem. You need a consultant? Okay, Air Southwest or Air America or Air whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Just, okay, get the job done. But politicians cannot be trusted. They cannot be spending that goddamn much money to get that job when there's no bottom line profit. Because that profit's got to go to somebody. I'm not saying there's any corruption involved.
Anything else you'd like to talk about?
I probably run my mouth too much.
No.
Probably sounding like a politician now.
No. Well, the interview is about you, so you're supposed to talk. Well, why don't we go ahead and stop this and end the interview. Thank you very much.